We'll call the Game Fish Committee to order. Quorum is present. First item is Representative Mo, have you reviewed the minutes of the February 18th meeting?
I have reviewed them thoroughly, and everything is as I remember it.
Okay, Representative Mo moves the minutes of the February 14th meeting for adoption. Any discussion on the motion? There being none, all in favor, aye?
Aye.
Motion prevails. All right, the first bill that is going to come, we're going to hear today is House File 1188, which we are going to lay over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Game and Fish Bill. Representative Scalzi, I believe you're the author, and you have an amendment. I believe it's a delete-all amendment, the 1128 amendment, is that correct?
Yes, you're right.
Representative Mo, can you move the 1128 amendment?
Yes, Chair Deal, I moved the
1128
amendment.
Okay, 1128, this is to get it in the shape the author wants, members, so we'll, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
And opposed? The motion is adopted. Now, Representative Scalzi, two-year bill as amended, House File 1188.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. We've heard this bill a little bit last year on the House floor, and so it's not quite new, but I just want to show you these are regarding the fish farming in natural waters. This is a stack of reports that the DNR has produced since 2000. There's always been a question of what's happening and how do you correct this and how much should we charge. And so I just wanted you to kind of see how much work has been done in the past on this. And in the process of coming to this committee, we checked around a little bit around the country, and we discovered that Michigan and Missouri don't allow commercial fish farming in their natural waters. Arkansas, we've heard a little bit about, uses only man-made ponds and has for four generations. But when we called New York, state of New York, there's a white paper that's been put out by the New York aquaculture industry. And they import almost all their bait fish from Arkansas and from the Midwest. And even in their state hatchery system, their aquaculture coordinator says that they purchase their bait fish from Minnesota and Arkansas. And so what we see in what's happening in the fish farming industry is that, for instance, in Arkansas, they use man-made ponds, have for four generations, and you'll hear a little bit about that in a minute. But they drain their ponds 7 to 15 years only. I mean, they keep that same water and try to reuse it because water is so precious. And in your packet, you have a picture of a man-made pond fish farm. This is in Minnesota. So I want to make sure that you look at that, because this is someone who's done commercial fish farming in Minnesota, mortgaged his farm to do it, and is working at quite a competitive disadvantage to someone who's using natural public waters. I don't know if you've got that in your packet, but that's a Minnesota fish farm. Yep, very good. You also have some information in your packet from, that's called the minnow sales. And you also have the one that we talked about on the House floor last year, which is a map of where the ponds intersect with where the fish farming licenses intersect with ponds that have been purchased, the easement has been purchased with federal duck stamp dollars. And it turns out it's, after a long study by the DNR, it's 14.1%. So part of this bill addresses the fact that those dollars have been spent to assure duck breeding habitat, and we are at the current time in 14% of those, of what we licensed for aquaculture, 14% of those have had easements purchased by the Fish and Wildlife Service with the federal duck stamp, which is a required stamp. If you want to go duck hunting, you have to have that stamp. You don't have any choice. Wisconsin only allows commercial fish farming in natural waters that freeze out in 2 of 5 years. And that's how they sort of clean up their ponds, because when you freeze out, all the undesirable fish are gone. And then you start again next year. So it's not like you're continually degrading it and taking out all the vegetation at one time. But we're doing quite a bit of exporting of fish, and at this time I'd like to have Roy Johannes come up and kind of explain this one report that talks about what we're raising and what we're exporting. He can give you the numbers.
Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record and who you represent, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Roy Johannes. I work with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, and I take care of licensing of aquaculture in the state, and I also take care of our fish production program for Minnesota for cool and warm water fish species. In referring to the document that you have regarding the harvest and sale of minnows in Minnesota, there are two different type of licenses that we offer. One is an aquaculture license, which allows individuals to apply for this license and have waters approved for that license for the rearing of fish. The other report that's on there deals with the licensing of individuals that apply for minnow dealer licenses, which allows them to harvest minnows from any water that's not closed and that they have legal access for. So an example would be is that in the morning they could work a river in the central part of the state, in the afternoon they could be in the southeast part of the state collecting minnows for sale. Over the years, exporting of minnows has been an important business for them, and as you'll see with records of 2005 and 2006, that about 60% of the minnows that are harvested are exported to eastern states, western states of the United States, and so on. And we have various species that are important for sales, and those are fathead minnows, golden shiners, white suckers that are raised on an aquaculture license, and primary business for Minnesota is the leech business, which is one of the largest in the country.
Yeah, I'm sorry, you said leech?
Leeches.
Mm-hmm.
With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions that members of the committee may have, Mr. Chairman.
Could you tell us, I don't see any questions right off the bat, could you tell us how leeches, the farming of leeches affects the ecological nature of the waters versus farming of minnows?
Well, there are two species that are synergistic in shallow wetlands, and those are leeches and fathead minnows, and they have to live together for survival. One can't live without the other. These are ponds that usually are frequently winter kill, and when Representative Scalzi talked about winter kill lakes in Wisconsin, for a good leech pond, it would have to winter kill 4 out of 5 years rather than 2 out of 5, and that's an important part of it. The leeches deposit their eggs, which form cocoons under the bottom of lily pads each August, and as the fertility goes, they feed on decomposing minnows during the year, and primarily fathead minnows is their feeding unit.
Okay, any questions by committee members? Fred Zemmo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate you coming to testify. I'm curious about if we do nothing, we don't act on the Scalzi legislation, what might cause you currently to deny an aquaculture license in public waters? Is there a certain amount of habitat destruction or something else? I mean, is there some criteria currently where you would actually...
Yes, we do have some representative, Mr. Chairman, representative. We do have some criteria in statutes in Chapter 17 that we use. The first thing we look at to see if there's any connections to public waters, and if there is a connection, we're typically not allowed to license that, or if we were required to deny it. However, if there's an intermittent connection, and we look at ability to screen it or prevent the connection and keep private and public fish separate, then we can go ahead and do that. Now, usually our rule of thumb is that we use typical intermittent flow of what is called 1 cubic foot per second, which is a pretty substantial flow. And if we look at any flows that are larger than that, we won't allow that license. We also look at species that are requested by the licensee and what they would raise in a certain body of water. And if we are in certain areas of the state where that species is not indigenous, we may require other requirements, such as being in above the 25-year floodplain so it can't escape into our public waters, which would affect our fishing and other types of things like that. We would look at denying a license of a aquaculture facility pond if the licensee would lose access to that body of water, and that occurs once in a while when there is competition for riparian access to that particular water. So those are the criteria that we're using right now for approving or denying a license for use for rearing fish.
Representative Moe?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So could you estimate how many permits do you actually deny for that are on public waters? I mean, is this a common occurrence? Maybe Representative Scalzi might have this if you don't. No. Does that happen?
Yep. Mr. Chairman, Representative Moe, what we do is we haven't had a lot of applications for new waters, and that's because we've looked at not adding a lot of waters during this time when we've had legislation being considered. And last year we had probably five or six applications. We did deny one, and that was based on a water connection. It was in the headwaters of the southern part of the state where we felt that if private aquaculture did move in there, that we would have impacts to the waters that were managed for game fish below. Typically, on an average year, we have transfer and change of up to five or six waters per year based on either lost access or change in water levels of that pond.
One.
Go ahead, Demo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And how often, if at all, do you go back and rescind licenses based on new information or ecological considerations that perhaps weren't considered before?
Representative Moe, we collect information all the time on our ponds, and each year as we're going through the renewals, we're looking to see if there's different activities going on. At this time, I would say that maybe there would be a dropping of a pond based on the licensee's request, knowing that they no longer have access or the pond is not suitable for raising fish anymore because it may have been inundated by piling or ditching to have other fish in there, and it's no longer a value to them.
So, Mr. Chairman, so then for deterioration of that aquatic ecosystem, that doesn't usually come up as a condition for rescinding a license?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moe, that's correct.
Thank you.
Joanne, do you, I may have missed this because we were discussing the bill here among staff, and do you, the 14.1% of licensed ponds that have been paid for with duck stamp money that Representative Scalzi referenced, and I think that's what you said, Representative Scalzi,
right.
If someone were to apply for a permit today in a pond that was a new permit, would you issue that permit, and would you know if it had an easement on it that was purchased by the Fish and Wildlife Service, or for that matter with state funds or with DU funds? You know how they go together on all these things, you know, a co-op them.
Yes.
How would you handle that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, what we're doing right now is we put together some policy where we just learned of this information last year as a request of Representative Scalzi. As part of discussions in the legislature last year, we were able to present this information at our legislative tour in August, and this is the first time we've had a chance to review that. Since that, we have this information on hand right now. We've been putting together some internal policies, giving great consideration to this information, and right now we've used a figure of 25% or greater as something. What I mean by that, if 25% of the riparian land around of water is listed as being an easement either for either duck stamp or federal waterfowl management, we would not move forward with approval of that pond.
Okay.
And those are right now, that's just an internal discussion policy.
I have another question. How long are the permits on the 14.1% that Representative Scalzi referenced? How much longer are those permits valid for, would you say, in general? Are they, how long are those permits? So my point is there some time that we could phase out of those permits in the future as they would come up for renewal?
Mr. Chairman, we're in the process of renewing licenses right now, and one of the things that becomes a difficult issue is where the five-year license stands, because what happens once a water is approved, it's approved for 5 years at a time, and we're looking at ways to discern how to make the decision on when that 5 years is up, and then we can review that renewal again.
So there's not a date that it's effective and a date that it ends, the 5 years? Did I miss that correctly?
Mr. Chairman, what happens is that what, say a body of water is approved this year, it'll be approved until 2013.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what we do is we look at things annually as we do the review.
Okay. Representative McNamara, you left. Did you have a question?
No, but I did.
Oh, Representative Simpson.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Moe kind of hit on some of the same things I was looking at, but it sounds to me like the DNR is getting a lot of information together in this last period of time. And have you really looked at or had a chance to put together what the DNR would feel would be a preferred amount of ponds or a preferred amount of production? These numbers that seem to be here, you know, you're showing 106,000 pounds. Is that an ideal amount, or should it be 50,000, or should it be 250,000? Has anything been done towards that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simpson, no, we have not looked at a capping on the number of poundage produced. What we have looked at as part of our recommendations is suggested that we look at a cap on the number of waters licensed and look at that down the road rather than put a cap on production.
Okay, thank you.
That's it? Okay, any other questions?
I just wanted to point out two.
Go ahead, Representative Scalzi.
This one, that minnows altogether, we are producing 356,000 gallons in Minnesota,
mm-hmm.
but we're exporting 170,000 gallons. So that's somewhere between 50% and 60% we're exporting. And I think the interesting thing is that we exported 29,000 gallons of shiners. And if anybody saw Sunday's paper, we've got a shortage of shiners. And I think that what we're doing is exporting things that we could be using for our own bait and fish industry in Minnesota. We've gotten a huge industry in Minnesota. And that's the first part of this bill here with the underline is that to propose to the legislature to make the aquaculture industry pay for itself. Because another piece of information you have there shows that our expenditures, annual expenditures, are $333,000, but the revenues are $170,000. So that money's coming from somewhere else.
Why don't we bring Mr. Bogus up, because I got a question for him. If anyone have a question, Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Scalzi, on that comment that you made about that we're exporting mm-hmm. how many pounds or gallons, I'm sorry, I didn't catch that, but in that article that was in the paper, I found that interesting. Is it the fact that the cash payment that these people are receiving outstate is greater than they would if they kept them in-state, or what seems to be moving that market? Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know the answer to that, but I would hope that whatever we're doing in the state would help our bait dealers in Minnesota, because we have a huge fishing industry and we depend on those bait dealers. And maybe it's that. Maybe we're not. Maybe they're making more money out state. I don't know. I'm thinking that the state of New York, if they don't want to use their natural public waters like we are, is probably paying a little bit more because it's cost. It's, you know, they don't have to deal with the cost to run their aquaculture bait fish program. And I think that that may be of interest to people in Minnesota, that we want to take care of our own fishing industry in Minnesota.
To that point, I think supply and demand will offset that. I mean, if shiners is an issue and they're available, if fishermen are willing to pay $8 a dozen for them in Minnesota, they're going to pay $8 a dozen. And if they can get more than that elsewhere, the market will drive it.
You're right.
So.
And I don't know, Representative Scalzi, how much this has to do with it, but, you know, our nearest neighbor, if you take a lot, where you're from, Lake of the Woods area, I mean, you can't import any bait essentially now from the U.S. into Canada. In my own backyard, I can see Canada from my house, is 200 yards away, and, you know, off my dock, I can fish with a minnow I bought in town, but 100 yards from my dock, I can't fish with that minnow. So I don't know how that has affected, you know, the supply and demand of bait. I suspect that we're trying to find new markets for the minnows that we did sell and the leeches that we did sell going to Canada. I'm just thinking that could be a part of that component. I have some questions on the fee part, since Representative Scalzi brought up the fees from Mr. Boggess. You know, in the 2004 legislature, well, that period of time when we had the huge budget deficit, $4.5 billion, the DNR recommended many fee increases that were ultimately adopted by the legislature. Why would the fees for aquaculture be so lopsided, as if the numbers that Representative Scalzi has given us is correct, where you have an income? Well, Representative Scalzi, why don't you state those numbers quickly?
Yes, and this I got from the DNR last week. The expenditures were $333,000, and the revenues were $170,000. So we're making half as much as we're, I mean, we're spending double what we're making in. And it could be because of the cost of the permit. Our licenses are set in statute at $210 a license. For instance, if you want to raise white suckers in Minnesota, you buy a $210 license, and DNR sells you the eggs too. Now, if you go to North Dakota, that's an illegal bait in North Dakota, unless you use it in the Red River. North Dakota does not allow white suckers, and it's right on their website. They don't allow it in their potholes and in their shallow lakes.
Well, maybe Representative Scalzi answered the question, but do you have any further comment on that, Mr. Boggess? And what's the department's position on fee versus expense in this matter? Because, I mean, we had all kinds of things that we, you know, had arguments that we needed to raise fees so that we had at least a break-even situation. But yet I don't recall that you've come forward with initiative on this instance.
Mr. Chair, members, Ed Boggess, for the record, with the Division of Fish and Wildlife, the DNR, and you're correct, a few years ago, we did bring a fairly comprehensive fee package on a number of commercial licenses. I don't recall that aquaculture was one of those that was in that fee package at the time, but we had the Game and Fish Fund Budget Oversight Committee, Mr. Chairman, which you're now a member of, had recommended that we recover the costs associated with commercial activities. And as we looked at our expenditures compared to the fees, the amount of additional fees that would have been required to fully recover our costs, there was a little bit of sticker shock. So a lot of those ended up getting scaled back a little bit. And I would have to do some checking to recall if we had even proposed an increase in the aquaculture fees, because they're located in not only in the game and fish statutes, but also in the agriculture statutes. But it is something that we're looking at again now in this fiscal environment, not only for aquaculture, but for a variety of other commercial fishing and aquatic plant and other activities. And we're not prepared this session to propose changes, but I would guess in the next biennial budget session you might see another adjustment to these types of fees being proposed.
So the answer is it's on your radar then, here?
Mr. Chair, it's on our radar, yes.
Okay. I had a question, and maybe you're the person to answer this, and I'd also like to hear from Representative Scalzi. In the bill, there are numerous references, and I won't cite them, but there are numerous references to restoring the wetlands to their original condition. And I'm not sure that I know that they're, how would you determine when, what original condition? I mean, how would you get to that original condition? Does that mean the condition that it was in when you licensed it, does that mean the condition it was in when it occurred? What is the original condition? That maybe I hear from Representative Scalzi and then hear from the DNR and see how obtainable that is.
Mr. Chair, there's a couple of places in the statute currently that talk about that significant detrimental impact to the wetlands. That the license, it can't be licensed if there's a significant detrimental impact. And the other part in the license in the 17.4984 statute states that the license issued by the commissioner is not a determination of private property rights, but is only based on a determination that the license does not have a significant detrimental impact on the public resource. So whoever wrote this law in 92 did a really good job, because it really protected the state from somebody thinking that a license was theirs forever, because it isn't. It's not a property right. And they can only get the license if there's a determination that the license does not have a significant detrimental impact on the public resource.
Okay, I can understand that, but I still need to know, how are we going to determine what the original condition is? I've got it circled here a few times. Line 2.6 in the bill, it says, will be restored to its original condition. So I assume from your testimony that the original condition, the baseline, is the quality or the way the wetland is operating on the date that they licensed it.
Yes, and I'm going to pass around some pictures that are, thank you, and just they're all the same. I mean, they're all different. So those pictures come from Hidden Lake in, I think it's Grant County. That lake shows pictures of what the wetland looked like, I believe it's 1994, and then it's got pictures of what it looks like today. And in that wetland, there was a license to farm white suckers. And just recently, there's been a lawsuit filed. The lawsuit's been settled out of court because Minnesota is one of those states where we have riparian lake rights. 29 states east of the Mississippi, and including Minnesota, have riparian lake rights. That's different from the western states that have prior appropriation waters. In other words, on the riparian waters, the property owner has reasonable use of the body of water. Now, this lawsuit was brought for loss of property rights, trespass, and nuisance, and it was brought by a law firm, large law firm. And based on the fact that Minnesota was in violation of federal law for the riparian property rights. Now, this lawsuit was just recently settled out of court. The fish farmer has signed the agreement, and a covenant is being currently written for every riparian owner around that body of water. And it's being filed with the county. And the intent of this legislation is to show that we really don't want to make more and more work for lawyers, but I think this is going to happen more in the future. And this was settled out of court, so we don't have a precedent-setting decision, but it was settled out of court for a reason. And this is just a fairly recent lawsuit that was brought.
Mr. Boggess, do you have any comment on this original condition question and possibly what the lawsuits that you just referenced?
Mr. Chair, we did have some discussions with Representative Scalzi last year when this bill was introduced about the intent of that word. I guess we think it's still a little bit ambiguous. Is it the original condition at the time of licensing, and at what point does it need to be restored? Our understanding from previous discussions was it was not necessarily, if it was in a degraded condition at the time of licensing, it wasn't just to keep it at that degraded condition, but actually to restore it. Now, maybe that's different than what you're thinking now, Representative Scalzi, but I guess in its form that it's in the bill right now, it's a little bit ambiguous to us, Mr. Chair, as to what the original condition is referring to. And when it needs to be restored, is it continuously throughout the licensing period, or is it at the end of when the license expires, it has to be restored. So there's just some questions that we have about that term and how and when it's applied.
And I think what it says is original. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry about that. What the bill says is the original ecological value for supporting waterfowl and other aquatic wildlife. So you can tell with a water body that has been impaired or degraded by the introduction of white suckers. You can tell what that water body is like, and I'm not a scientist, but I've got somebody here who can come up and tell us maybe what the ecological value of that water would be for waterfowl and other fish and wildlife. I think the law is clear, and I'm not attempting to change that part of the law that determines that there's not a significant detrimental impact. And I think there's many things that impair wetlands and waters. There's no doubt about that. This is just one little piece of the puzzle. As we're looking at clean water legacy and putting a lot of money into the bonding bill for purchase of lands and maybe trying to create some wetlands for waterfowl, we're spending a lot of money in this regard. And if the voters pass the clean water, the dedicated funding amendment, we're going to be spending millions on this. I think that it behooves us to continue to not work toward trying to determine what the original value of that wetland is. I don't know the value of all the wetlands. I would assume that the DNR is the agency in our state that knows that.
My last question, and you want to get to some public testimony, and then we'll go on to some other bills. In Section 3 of the bill, 3.13, it talks about the commissioner shall, over the next 5 years, restore natural waters that have become degraded by aquatic farm operations that have been taken out of production. Do we have any idea, is the department prepared to embark on that in any way, and where would the money come from, Mr. Bogus, or Representative Scalzi for that matter, to start that kind of a initiative?
If you're asking me, Mr. Chair, one of these books here, I mean, we know different ways to restore wetlands. Walleye stocking is one way that we do it. The walleye fry, eat the fathead minnow fry, we've talked about that. There's other ways. Some people introduce bass. There's biological ways to try to restore that wetland. There's ways that you can do it by trying to restore the vegetation that surrounds the wetlands. And I think that by giving 5 years, I'm not saying you have to do it today. I'm just saying we want to use our resources, but we want to keep our resources the way they were, or if not the way they were, even better. And that's what we're trying to do with the Clean Water Legacy. We're not trying to just stay the same or just keep them the way they are. We want to eventually have clean wetlands and water bodies in this state. And we're willing in Clean Water Legacy to spend a lot of money to do it.
In the absence of Clean Water Legacy or dedicated funding, Mr. Bogus, where does the money come from to do this?
Mr. Chair, one of the problems that we've had is that there's so many factors affecting the quality of these wetlands that sorting out the impacts of fish. Are fish that are raised for aquaculture from other fish like bullheads and carp that aren't raised for aquaculture, or from runoff or other issues that some of these degraded basins, there may be other problems besides, in fact we know there are other problems in some of these degraded basins besides just the aquaculture. So that's been one of the reasons we've done all the research that Representative Scalzi talked about, is trying to sort out what can we figure out and what can't we figure out. And in some cases, if it's a wetland that's full of fathead minnows, we might very well be able to go in there with walleye rearing and suppress the reproduction of those fathead minnows. We might be able to induce some winter kill in some basins, and if it's just a fish problem, clear them up. But if that basin has other bigger problems in the watershed, then it will take something like a Clean Water Legacy or something that operates on more of a landscape watershed scale to clean up those bodies of water. We don't have the resources to do all of that.
Representative Lagunias, this is pretty near and dear to you. Do you have any questions before I go to public testimony?
Well, this near and dear, and thank you for recognizing that. And I'm sorry that I have another committee right now, too. But I am curious about, and perhaps you've mentioned, but I think it'd be worth repeating, the cost of your running this program versus the income you bring in from this program.
Mr. Bogus, Representative Lagunias, we were on that before you came, but because you are the chairman of that committee, we'll have Mr. Bogus answer it again.
That's good. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lagunias, we have recently been looking at, because we've been looking at imbalances in fisheries and wildlife revenues and expenditures, we've been looking at a variety of commercial fees and what we're spending, whether it's commercial fishing, aquaculture, aquatic plant management, and other fees, and our estimate for the last two fiscal years is that we've spent about $333,000 on administering these programs, and our revenues from license fees and inspection fees have been about $171,000.
Representative Lagunias.
So that's troubling that we're subsidizing a program that, like, it can be damaging to our environment. That's, I trust you have some way to remedy this?
Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lagunias, we did talk about earlier, too, that we do not have a fee initiative this session, but we're talking about in the next biennial budget looking at all of our commercial fees. And I can't say what's going to be in the administration's biennial budget, but as we said earlier, it is on our radar screen. It's something that we're looking at.
Well, Representative Lagunias, I have some concerns about the bill, but I also have that same concern that you have. I don't want to see fees and things go up just for the sake of going up, but on the other hand, I share that concern with you. We could go to Representative Scalzi.
Before we go to public testimony, I had one more person I wanted to bring up to talk about the ecology, but I did want to mention that we have met with the DNR. We met about 2 weeks ago, according to what we put into the law last year, and they made some recommendations, but they were not ready to do a bill yet. And I would gladly have included this bill with their bill, and I offered them that, but they weren't quite ready. So, because by having the $210 in statute for the license fee, it leaves them no wiggle room. So we should change this so that it allows them to set aside policy or some other method. But at this time, I'd like to bring up Tom Landwehr, because we've had a little bit of question about the ecology of the wetlands and what happens with the benthivorous fish, and maybe you could help us.
Welcome, Mr. Landwehr. I think everybody knows you. Go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Landwehr.
That's you.
Thank you, Mr. Landwehr. I'm Mr. Dill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tom Landwehr. I'm the Assistant State Director for the Nature Conservancy in Minnesota, but I want to make it real clear that this is not, I'm not here on behalf of the Nature Conservancy today. The Conservancy has a very formal process for getting involved in legislative issues, and this is not one of the issues that our board has tackled this year. Rather, I believe I'm here for my past lives. For 5 years, I worked for Ducks Unlimited. I was a conservation program manager in Minnesota and Iowa for Ducks Unlimited. Prior to that, I worked for the Department of Natural Resources for 17 years, the last 9 of which I was the Wetlands Wildlife Program Leader for the Department of Natural Resources, and worked very closely with this issue, as you might guess, both here at the Capitol as well as with stakeholders and my clientele, which was duck hunters, who were very concerned at that point in time about the diminishing migrations of the birds through Minnesota. I'd very briefly like to visit some of the ecology. If you think back to pre-settlement times in Minnesota, what the wetlands looked like. We had twice as many wetlands as we have now. We have roughly 8 million acres of wetlands right now in the state of Minnesota. We had about 16 million at the time of settlement. But most of the losses of those wetlands have been in the western part of the state. The Prairie Pothole region, where we've lost probably 90 to 99% of all of our wetlands. And those are really the wetlands that are of most issue here, the wetlands in the Prairie Pothole region, because they are inherently very fertile, because they are open water wetlands and they're suitable for raising fish. When you look pre-settlement time what those wetlands looked like, primarily they were isolated. That means they had no surface connection. Most of our wetlands were just bowls of water that had no connection to other surface waters.
They were mostly shallow, less than 6 to 10 feet deep. Consequently, they froze out every year. They were clear water wetlands. That is, they have rooted plants, what we call macrophytes, and a lot of invertebrates in them that help keep the water clear. The reason I mention this is because today we have dramatically changed these wetlands. Today we have, obviously we've drained half of our wetlands and 90% of those in the prairies. We have interconnected most of our wetlands. We have ditches and tile lines that run not only through the wetlands to drain them, but also to the Minnesota River and other places where we have fish migration. Wetlands are subject to nutrients and pesticides. They are facing onslaughts of invasive species every day. And just all sorts of pressures that are really diminishing their value to wildlife and to hunters as a result of that. A little bit of an example, if I could, and I think you've heard this from two other Minnesota researchers, Kyle Zimmer, who is currently a professor at the College of St. Thomas, and Mark Hansen, who's a researcher with the Department of Natural Resources, have done a lot of work specifically with looking at fathead minnows and their introduction into wetlands. We know from their work that when you introduce fatheads into wetlands where they weren't previously, they eat invertebrates. They eat the small bugs. Those small invertebrates would have eaten the algae. In the absence of those invertebrates, the algae blooms. When you get an algae bloom, it prohibits the growth of rooted plants. As a result, you have no rooted plants. You end up with an algae-dominated bowl of water without any plants in it. Virtually useless for waterfowl, virtually useless for things like muskrats, and not a hospitable environment even for things like amphibians, because fish eat amphibians both as eggs and as young animals. You see a big decline in amphibians as well. We don't have comparable information for fish that I'm aware of, for fish like white suckers and walleyes, but we do have enough evidence to indicate that these introducing these species into wetlands does create problems. For instance, white suckers are benthivores. They feed on invertebrates in the bottom of the pond, and as a result of both their feeding activities and their swimming activities, they have a tendency to stir up the sediments in the bottom and create a turbid water state. We know that we have problems when you introduce species into systems that didn't belong in those systems, and I think the question today is not do we completely prohibit those, but how do we deal with those problems that we may have created in our quest to get some monitored resources out of these wetlands.
Okay, Representative McNamara, did you have a question of Flint or a couple of the other testifiers? I know I have you on the list. I'm sorry.
It actually was more for the DNR, Mr. Chick. I can wait until you want to wait until they're back up.
They'll probably be back up again.
Yeah.
So thank you very much, and now let's go to some public testimony. From Mackenzie Fish, are you here? Welcome. If you'd
like to state your name for the record, who you represent, go ahead with your testimony.
Hi, I'm Steve Puchtel from Mackenzie Fish, the chair and representative. I always get a little bit nervous when I have
to. No, don't worry about it.
Okay.
Take a deep breath.
And I've worked with Representative Scalzi on this bill a little bit, and Representative Lagunas. I've been her committees before. One of the things we lose track of sometimes is, I think we all want clean water in this state, but one of the things that I look at is, a lot of this has affected my business, a lot of this duck stuff. One of the things I see that if they want to have all of the riparian landowners have permission on the land, most of the water that I use, one farmer owns all the land around it. And they want to control that water, and they want to tell us what we can do with it. And I think the farmers have a right to lease that water to me. They don't have a right to ruin that water, but I do believe they have the right to do it, to receive income from leasing out that water. And I see this bill stopping that. One of the other things that I see is if riparian landowners, if we have to get permission from all riparian landowners, the duck hunters don't get permission from all the riparian landowners to use that water to duck hunt on. Water skiers don't get permission from all riparian landowners. Jet skiers don't. Fishermen don't. I see this as singling out just one business and saying that we have to get permission from everybody to use the water when no other businesses do, or people that pick well plants don't have to get permission from all riparian landlords to walk along the shoreline and do what they do. One of the other things I see that we miss all the time is, I was there when they raised the fees on the fish farming bill from $70 and went to $210. That was a 3-time increase just 4 or 5 years ago. We thought that was enough. We agreed to it. Most other fees did not go up 3 times. One of the other things that what fish farmers do for the state of Minnesota is why the fee is maybe a little bit higher than what the fees it cost them to manage us than it is for what they receive back, is we meet a need for the public in the state of Minnesota. I stock trout for private people that the DNR can't stock in their own private waters. I stock walleyes for private lake associations that the DNR cannot stock. Those people who live on that lake want walleyes in their lake. The DNR cannot meet that demand because it doesn't have a public access. And we do that. And that is a viable job, I think, that we meet for all the people in the state. And nobody ever talks about what the good that we do. All we ever hear about is how we're depriving and wrecking the water for the waterfall. Well, I personally am a duck person myself. I don't want to ruin it for the ducks. I'm only speaking for myself right now. I'm the past president of the state organization. I am in agreement with Representative Scalzi. If the waterfall people own the water, they should be able to do what they want with it. And I have been with that all along. And I see that one thing we can do is we can take some of the water, and the water that I have, I'm in western Minnesota, eastern part of the state is where my water is, that I farm fish in. That water is not the same water that's in the western part of the state. It doesn't have the same value. But if you're going to start passing laws, we're putting laws on values of water that aren't the same. The water in the eastern part of the state of Minnesota is real acidic. It's not really good for growing fish. It's not even very good for waterfall. We don't have a lot of waterfall on along the St. Clair River Valley. They're all at Western Flyway. So if we're going to start passing laws on water and water quality and stuff, we have to look at apples and apples and oranges, I guess. Is there any other questions?
Well, I want to make sure I got what you said right. You said that, I think you said,
yes.
And you can confirm it,
yes, sir.
That money that was spent from federal waterfowl stamps on wetlands that your association or you're representing yourself, you'd be willing to not have future development for minnow rearing. And how about the 14.1% that we already licensed? Are you amenable to having those licenses expire and not having those in production as well on the 14.1% that Representative Scalzi talked about?
Well, I can't speak for everybody. I'm only speaking for myself right now. But I'm in agreement with that if the duck people own the water and have easements to it to manage it for waterfall, then it should be managed for waterfall, or if fish can use it. Now, I think, but then we go back to what we do with riparian landlords. What about all the other people that live on that lake? There's only 25% of it. One farmer sold his land for an easement for waterfall. What about the other 3/4 of the people that live on that lake? What if they want fish in that lake? Now, we're taking away their riparian landowners, but I'm in agreement with Representative Scalzi. If the duck people want to manage that water for ducks, they should own all the water around it or manage all the water around it, and they should be able to have it for ducks.
Okay, Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Patel, I've got a few different questions. I'm familiar with a pond that's maybe like in the upper 30s, 36 acres or something, that's completely enclosed in an area that where we duck hunt. It's not currently farmed at all for minnows, but it's really full of fatheads. How many fatheads? I mean, it's unbelievably full of fatheads. How many fatheads can you get out of a pond like that big? Is there any idea how many you could get out of a pond like that?
Mr. Pucktail.
Well, I'm not an expert at this, but I've been playing with fish for 37 years. I had a fish hatch in Wisconsin already, so I have a little bit idea what's going on and what doesn't work. A lot of times people see fatheads, and they might be base minnows. I don't know where the water is, but it depends on... I have one small pond that has some horse farmers on it that gets a lot of manure from the horse farmers, and that produces... That's a five-acre pond, and that produces about 100 gallons of fatheads a year. But I keep cropping that off, and I just use that to feed my walleye.
Okay. Mr. Representative McNamara.
Well, my point is, Mr. Chair and members, I think there's opportunities here. I mean, I don't want the fatheads in the pond. It's where we hunt, and I don't want them. But currently, I think it's unfortunate. What if we were farming those? Say I wanted the income off of that and wanted to sell the fatheads and allow them to be taken off. I'm curious to know, Mr. Chair, how many ponds could we eliminate being farmed for fatheads? I'm wondering if we're managing the number of ponds properly. That's my question. Here's one. The duck hunting's lousy on that pond because it's got fatheads in it. Or I take that back. It's lousy for hunting and it has fatheads on it. I don't know what causes what, but the ponds around it aren't infested with fatheads and they're better for ducks. My point is, I'm wondering if there's some compromise here. Why aren't we using some of these ponds that are inundated with fatheads and harvesting them there, and then maybe we wouldn't need to use some of the ponds that we could begin to restore? That's where I think we need to look at, because I'm wondering, is this typical? And that's why I guess I would like to ask, that's a question for the DNR when that I get that chance, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any further questions for Mr. Puckdell? Don't see any. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else in the audience like to testify for or against the bill? Doesn't appear there's anyone. If Mr. Boggess could come back. Did you hear Representative McNamara's question?
If I understood the question correctly, it was... how are we managing the ponds and how many more bait minnows maybe could be harvested than are currently, if we could identify ponds like the one that you're familiar with? Is that
right, Mr. Chair and Mr. Boggess? I think my point is, do one of your fisheries people know how many minnows could we be getting out of a pond that's not properly managed? In other words, this pond is got the fatheads in it, and so it's degraded, or it could be degraded. I mean, it is degraded. It's degraded, whether it's because of the fatheads, but they're there. I mean, I'm wondering if we're really missing opportunities. There's a lot of these infested waters that if we're going to have them infested, why aren't we taking the minnows out of them? And I'm wondering if Representative Scalzi's got a good point that we should reduce some of the numbers here. And I'm wondering if we can't do that, but make sure the minnow farmers have places to get the minnows. I don't know that we're properly capitalizing in all the ponds, I'll use the word, that are infested with fatheads. I guess if you were raising minnows, you'd say they're your home ground or whatever.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, I'm going to let Mr. Johannes take a shot.
Mr. Johannes.
But just quickly before I turn it over to him, there's a lot of... there's a lot of bait that's trapped right now under a minnow trapping license, and in our whole discussion of aquaculture, we've been specifically focused on fish that are intentionally placed in the wetlands to be raised there and not on the wild trapping of bait, which there's a lot of that goes on too, and I'll let Mr. Johannes talk about that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, I'd like to just address the fact that fathead minnows are one of the unique minnows in the state where they reproduce several times a summer, so their population can really explode in a pond where they're under-exploited, would be the best way to describe it. As the law stands right now, if a minnow dealer is contracted to come in and harvest a pond, what will happen is that they can come in and harvest it down pretty well in the springtime. But as I said, the reproduction will take place several times during that summer, and that population will rebound by fall. And as long as they have access to do that, they can continue to come in and harvest it. We do work with the number of the wildlife managers around the state where we have waterfowl management areas, and we do biomanipulation, so to speak, where we put in walleye fry into a pond for harvest and cropping of minnows, and usually that takes 1 to 2 seasons and we're out of there. And as far as the fisheries people, we get the fish out and we're done with that pond for a few years unless the fatheads rebound again. But those are things that we do to allow that. If we do hear about opportunities for dealers, we can recommend a few dealers in your area for your pond to come in and to do some harvesting if that's something that you're interested in. There are stipulations when we do work with the WMAs is that we don't allow harvest during the spring and fall season, which are the real key times for the ducks. We do allow a lot of under ice trapping, which can really be pretty good at removing minnows from a pond.
All right. Well, members, we've done an hour on this bill now. And Representative Lagunias, I'm going to give you the last question, then we're going to hear from Representative Scalzi and go forward. Representative Lagunias.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's important to distinguish between a farmer who owns all the land around the wetlands, and that farmer certainly has the ability to lease it out. The question becomes, how many wetlands have 2, 3, 4 ownership? It's not like a lake where there's multiple sites. I think it would be important for us to know how many of those exist. And the reason I'm asking the question is I want to know how vulnerable we are to lawsuits.
Which one of you want to field that question?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lagunias, I don't know that we have the answer on how many of the licensed ponds right now have multiple ownerships versus single ownerships. Do we have that answer?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lagunias, all I can tell you is that I know in the prairie pothole areas we probably have maybe 3 to 4, maybe 5 landowners on some of the ponds. Some have single ownership. If we get more towards the metropolitan area, there are some waters that we have licensed that may have 60 or 70 landowners around that pond.
Okay, Representative Lagunias.
I think it's important for us to understand that question, because it's very easy to distinguish between a farmer and another landowner who has all the area around the wetland. And then you can let them rent it out as long as you follow the statute, which is pretty strict and doesn't seem to be followed right now. But when there are multiple owners and you give that license, then you're kind of setting us up for the ability to be sued. And I think if people understood that a little bit, and if that's what would happen. And so I think we need to know that number, and I think we need to be more cautious about, very cautious, about allowing licenses on farms that have multiple owners on wetlands that have multiple owners.
Okay, Representative Scalzi, your closing argument, please.
Yes,
we are going to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know, and I respect your time. You have a long agenda tonight, and I know you have the room for as long as you want it, but certainly you don't want to be here at midnight. But we do have a record of a recent lawsuit that was settled out of court, and for exactly the reasons that you stated, Representative. And we have, we can make more work for the lawyers, or we can take care of the situation on our own. And because we are a riparian state, we certainly have to respect that federal law, or we could be in deep trouble in this. And so we have that already. And I think that we did a good wetland law in 2007. We're trying to really work hard to make strides to clean up our wetlands in the state. We've spent, we're being requested millions for wetlands and grasslands in our bonding bill. And we're willing to do that because we think it's important to Minnesota. We've put out the dedicated funding amendment, as I said before. I think that every Minnesotan really wants to clean up the waters in the state. And I think that this is one way to do just one little part of why the waters are impaired. And it's one thing that we can do for the future.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, and we'll lay the bill over for possible inclusion. Okay, the next bill to come before us, which will also be laid over for possible conclusion, is House File 3219, Representative Briner.
Thank you.
Representative Breinhardt, that's to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'd like to introduce House File 3219, which intends to modify ammunition restrictions by adding additional cartridge calibers for use in deer zones, and because that's just about as much as I know about this bill, I would like to introduce Orville Stammerweiler, who is a constituent of mine, who brought this proposal to me on behalf of a group of fellow hunters and trappers. And when Orville is done testifying, Thomas Kelleher would like to say a few words on behalf of the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association.
Welcome to the committee. If you state your name for the record, go ahead with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, my name is Orville Stammerweiler, and before I start with my presentation, I have a handout.
We have it.
Of this ammunition. These are the three that we can use right now. The two on the end are fairly obsolete. The short is you can't even find those anymore. The three on the left here are the ones that we are trying to get to be able to use. The 22 mag was introduced in 1959. The 17 HMR was introduced in 2002. And the Mach 2 was introduced in 2004. On the back of the sheet, we have the ballistics. You can look at those. And if you look at the 22 long rifle that we can use and compare it to the rest of them, the velocity is almost doubled. Now I'll continue with my I am here to try to get Minnesota statutes 97B041, possession of firearms and ammunition restrictions in zoo zones, 97B621, raccoons, to include the 22 mag, 17 HMR, and the 17 Mach 2. I knew coming up here that Representative Tony Cornish was against this bill, but I came here to get this bill passed. Poultry seems to be the big block in the way that this bill passed. Yes, there is poaching going on. The question is how much. Now, to my understanding, there is no way to verify how much poaching is going on. And I'll come back to this statement in a minute. Poaching is going on, and maybe it's time to hit them where it hurts most, in the pocketbook. Maybe the laws need to be changed and made stiffer. Well, will it stop poaching? My guess is no. Does it stop people from driving intoxicated? No. Does it prevent people from killing people? No. The reason they do this is they all think they're going to get away with this. Another question you may ask is, why do you want to hunt predators during the deer season and not deer? I will answer that. The DNR has put out hunting season in which we can hunt. And it happens that the fur-bearing hunting season runs through with the deer season. I have paid for a license which allows me to hunt predators. I want to hunt predators, and not everybody wants to hunt deer. As far as the 17s and the 22 mag being more effective killers, yes, they are. The hunting industry has given us technology to come up with better ammunition to kill game quickly and humanely. Now, isn't that our goal? The 17s and the 22 mag will do just that. Now, getting back to my question of poaching and not being able to verify how much poaching is going on, if we cannot verify, how can we say that the 17 and the 22 mag are even a factor? It poacher will use any weapon at his or her disposal, no matter what caliber. Last year, the bull weight was dropped from 45 pounds to 30 pounds. Why was that? It's new technology the industry gave to the archery industry. Now the hunting industry gave us the technology and ammo in the 17 and the 22 mag to kill and take game quickly and humanely. Now it's your job and obligation as members of the DNR and you as legislators to allow us as hunters to go afield with the best equipment to take game quickly and humanely. The 17s and the 22 mag will do just that. This argument has gone on for years, and we have to stop using poaching as a crutch to solve all our hunting problems. It's time to put it to rest. The hunting industry gives the technology in the 17s and the 22s made to do the job quickly and humanely, and it's time to pass Bill HF329. Now, if you have any questions, I will try to answer them to the best of my ability.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony. I just want to let you know, with regard to Representative Cornish, I'm always trying to convince him to start thinking like a citizen rather than a conservation officer. Anyway, questions for the Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm not nearly so adamantly against this as what was said, and I could have written that letter. I agreed when we were conversing back and forth before that we don't know how much poaching is going on, but it's like with the crossbow and all these other things, just because we don't know how much doesn't mean we should open it all up. The reason we have 22 short, long, and long rifle for years and years is because it was originally meant to hunt small game, squirrels and rabbits. But we didn't want to shut squirrels and rabbit hunting off during deer season. During my youth, they started to get the calibers out, the 22 250 and 220 Swift and all those other hot calibers, and they wanted to use them, but they couldn't because they were being used to kill deer, too. And so, I just don't like the idea of getting the newer, faster, hotter, more flat trajectory shooting ammo out there during deer season because it does make it easier to take illegal deer. And true, if you said how many yards they're taking, there's no way to quantify it or judge it. It's just that you're making the tool that much more available to them. Just because there are fox and coyote and raccoon out there during deer season doesn't mean you have to hunt them. Some of the things we don't have to do, it makes sense to restrict the ammunition to 22 long rifle, and that makes it, that much speed. I own all these calibers, and in fact, a couple in each one, and an avid fox and coyote hunter myself, but I just, stick to the rules and hunt with the 22 or a shotgun and do it that way. So it's up to the committee what they want to do with this. It's just that I'm not a big fan of hotter ammo and flatter trajectory during deer season. I'd like to see the restriction kept the way it is.
Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess just on that point, do you have any idea or any comments for a testifier how many people this would involve? I mean, is this a big, obviously you're in favor of it, but is this a big demand? Are there a lot of people that would want to do this during this time frame?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Simpson, there's a lot of predator hunters out there that would like to go and do this. Not everybody wants to deer hunt. I paid for a license, and I'm losing 22 days of hunting because I firmly believe I cannot go out there and kill a predator at 100, 150 yards with a 22. A 22 is not big enough to do the job. And if I can't go out there and loosely kill and put down game, I'm not going.
Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Keller. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Hackler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to let Representative Simpson know that, strangely enough, I had a friend of mine that called me and wanted to do this very same thing this year, and I just thought it was kind of a coincidence that this bill is here, and my friend wanted to do the same thing. So there are folks out there that do this and see this as kind of more of a humane kill type situation.
Okay, and Ms. Keller.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Kelleher. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. We had a corporate board meeting this weekend. This was one of the issues that came before us. We wholeheartedly support this idea. It is a, from our perspective, just a redefinition of what is a short, a long, or a long rifle cartridge. with an addition of the .17 Mark II, the .17 HMR, and a .22 Magnum caliber. So we didn't talk about it real long. No one seemed to have any problems with it whatsoever.
So you're supporting it?
Yes, sir.
All right. Colonel Hamm.
What would Lloyd Dean do?
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, members. Colonel Mike Hamm, Chief Conservation Officer with the Department of Natural Resources.
Your position.
Mr. Chair and members, I certainly can see the author's interest for being able to want to change this, and certainly see Representative Cornish's end, because he is a former retired conservation officer, and of course I'm still a current conservation officer, and clearly there could be some concerns out there putting these types of firearms during the deer season when somebody is out hunting and some deer jumps up in front of them and gives them an opportunity, because a couple of these rounds, as you know, Mr. Chair, and some members know, are some pretty hot loads. But I would say that overall, I don't know that the department would have a position one way or the other.
Representative McNamara.
Mr. Chair and Colonel, I can't believe your last statement, but anyway, what are you guys going to take a position on? I'm sorry, I shouldn't say that. If I could, if I'm not mistaken,
Representative McNamara.
Man, I can't imagine this hot of a load being allowed to be used during the deer season, like where I'm from, you know, in the southern part of the state. This isn't a lot to me. These loads on the left side are not a lot different. One of my hunting partners continues. He absolutely swears by his 80 grain 6mm. Isn't that a lot closer to one of these loads on the left? I mean, the loads on the right are not going to be very effective at taking down a deer, but the loads on the left, I mean, we don't allow any kind of a rifle in the southern part of the state to be used currently except for the .22, correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, during the open firearms deer season, that's correct, but during the rest of the year, these rounds are in your neighborhood and in your backyard.
If I could, Mr. Chair, and I don't want to belabor it, I know you got a lot. I think we could consider the days before and the days after. Is that still in statute, Colonel?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes.
Okay, I would be open to the idea that we think about that. It used to be years ago, 5 days before, 10 days after. I just know how hot some of these loads are and how effective they are. This is a completely different direction, and I don't like the idea of assuming everybody's an outlaw. But this varmint hunting is becoming very popular, and I grew up in that tradition, and we had to wait through the gun season, and we couldn't use those, and we lived with it. You know, we hunt the other things during that. And I respect the testifier's point that some folks aren't, you know, they don't want to give that up. But I'm just concerned that we cut this loose. I can see it from an enforcement standpoint being pretty serious. And the reality is, generally in the southern part of the state, we don't have the snow yet anyway, so it's not as good a varmint hunting. I realize for the callers and stuff, but Mr. Chair, I just think it's going a little too far.
All right. Thank you very much. And Representative Beinart, anything else you'd like to add to this?
Oh, thank you for the hearing today.
And, sir?
I'd like to pose a question to Representative Cornish.
We don't ask committee members questions.
Right.
Okay.
We're going to have the questions being asked by us to you.
Okay, I'm sorry.
All right. I'll ask it for him later.
Just have to point out, though, that right now you can hunt coyote with the spur starts to get prime in October. You can hunt them October, November, December, January, and February. 5 months. They're still out there, our family, hunting them right now. We're talking about in the southern part of the state 2 days, maybe 3 days. Up in the northern part of the state, 3 weeks, deer season. I'm just thinking, why can't we just stop during the deer season? We don't have to hunt them. We got 5 months to hunt them to give the deer a break. That's all. It's no big deal.
All right, we're going to lay House File 3219 over. Thank you for coming out testifying. Thank you, Representative Bryant. Okay, the next bill going to come up before us is Representative Erickson, House File 2740. Okay, I want to make sure we got two different numbers. Okay. So, first off, members, there was some mix up on the number. It's House File 2740. And we're going to take that up for possible inclusion. And the one that was in your packet was House File 2470, authored by Representative Kahn. And we're not taking up that bill. We're going to clone some deer, but not... anyway, all right, so we're on House File 2740 for possible inclusion. And Representative Erickson, I'm the chief author on the bill, I think.
No, not this bill.
Oh, that's the other bill. Sorry.
Sorry.
This is over the albino deer. I'm thinking the fish house issue. So go ahead to the bill, 2740. I'm sorry. Well, I had them confused.
But, Mr. Chair, before we go ahead with 2740, I'd like to, with your permission, remove 2921 today because that's the bill that you're authoring that I asked you to author because we have to work out some things with the DNR.
On
the fish houses.
Okay, we can do that. Very fine.
Thank
so we're
you.
House File 2740 is before us now for possible inclusion.
Thank
go
you.
Ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, this is really exciting because 8 years ago, or maybe it's 9 years ago, I introduced this bill, but my colleagues wouldn't hear it. So I thank you for hearing it, Mr. Chair, because it's something that's very dear to the northern part of Mille Lacs County. And I have two testifiers, Tim and Carrie Rustline, who would tell you about the white deer who live in Mille Lacs County. In trying to work with the DNR to make this a palatable prohibition for us, I did limit it to Mille Lacs County. I realize that we don't have hunting zones by county, but the albino and white deer, for the most part, live in the northern part of Mille Lacs County. They live in Father Hennepin at Isle, at Cassio State Park, at Onania, and even as far south as the wildlife management area. Now, both the state parks, of course, have natural prohibitions because they're state parks. But a couple of weeks ago, Jason Davis came to the Rustline's home, and you may have seen on Channel 5 the coverage of what the Rustlines do for the white deer in the Waukon area. So with that, Mr. Chair, I ask you to recognize first Tim Rustline and then his wife, Carrie, and they will talk to you about why this is such an important prohibition.
Welcome to the committee and state your name and for the record, and we'll hear your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you.
Looks like
an
overgrown rabbit.
It does, doesn't it? Thank you, committee member. I'm an avid deer hunter. My name's Tim Rustline. I'm from Waukon, Minnesota, south end of Mille Lacs Lake. I'm an avid deer hunter and spend 16 days of Minnesota's gun season in the woods, and even after 18 years of marriage, my wife even understands me. So we need to make up for the loss of tourists by protecting the albino and white deer in Mille Lacs County. And I found some facts on the internet. 1 in 100,000 deer will be an albino. The chances of seeing three of them at one time is 1 in 79 billion. That's pretty rare.
They should be playing lottery tickets.
That's right. I don't think so. From the day an albino is born, the odds are stacked against them. Most will never reach adulthood. Their poor eyesight and pure white coat, they're unable to detect oncoming danger and don't blend into their surroundings like a normal white-tailed deer would. I have been very fortunate to have albino twins come to my backyard since 2006, and at that time they were only 6 months old. They'll be 2 years old this spring, and it's hard to believe that they're still coming to my feeder today. As a matter of fact, they were just here this morning. Rumor has it that albinos are supposed to be bad for the herd, And I don't claim to be an expert, but in the 2 years that I have been observing them in my backyard, it's pretty much the opposite. Actually, the herd's kind of bad for the albinos. They chase them away from the food source. They just, like, socially reject them. What the reason is for that, I don't know, but I did contact the DNR about what the odds would be of seeing twin albino deer. That's the ones that are at my house. They're twins, so that would actually make the odds a lot higher. But I was told that I couldn't be told any numbers because they haven't studied them enough to know. And this kind of leaves me asking the question about the bad for the herd situation. Where does that come in? If the albino deer are bad for the herd, why have 13 states already passed laws to protect them? And then all of a sudden this becomes a topic of who's right and who's wrong. And before I came down here, I was sure to speak to my friends who and family who are all hunters. And amazingly, I didn't receive any negative feedback from them. Actually, they told me that their children enjoyed seeing the albinos on television. And I've actually gone on some websites, posted the deer's picture on there, asked the question to other hunters, if you had grandchildren or children and the deer were coming into your backyard or you had a place where your children or grandchildren could see them, would you shoot them or would you want to preserve the right, you know, for them to see them in the future, a future generation? So I'm only going to ask you one thing today, and that's to take these photos home that I've passed around and show them to your family members, your younger children or grandchildren, and let them decide. I mean, it's a matter of morals, and it's a matter of, you know, I mean, you can't just turn your back on these things. The children just love them. My granddaughter's watched the TV show. She's run it 5 times in a row just to see these deer. And I've talked to a lot of hunters, and they all think, you know, they're rare and unique animals, and it's about ethics and morals. It's not really about putting a deer's head on the wall. It's really not. If they had children or if they have grandchildren, they understand totally. So protecting the deer in Mille Lacs County is not the sole subject here. It's actually about preserving our wildlife for the future generations. Thank you for your time. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer, Mr. Chairman.
Well, great. Any questions on the matter? I want to get Mr. Kelleher up here. He's smiling like a Cheshire cat.
He already told me he's fighting this one against me, so.
Well, I owe him a buck. And he knows what that's for. Go ahead.
I'm Sherry Russell. I'm City Clerk Treasurer of Waukon, as well as I have something here from Judy Keene, the Mille Lacs Area Tourism Executive Director. I'd like to read to you some facts about the tourism industry in the Mille Lacs area. We sit on the shores of the most regulated lake in the state and have to struggle to promote the area. Many of our resorts are being sold and developed into privately owned properties, condos, RV sites, so we have less to offer the consumer. Taxes for Lakeshore have quadrupled in the past 2 years, and this has forced many of them out of business. A huge amount of income is brought into the state because of the tourism destination of this 132,000-acre lake and its walleye. Mille Lacs County has a $50 million tourism industry. For every dollar spent in tourism marketing for Minnesota, returns $4.60 in state and local taxes, $20.40 in wages, and $53 in gross sales, $53. Minnesota's hospitality industry accounts for more than 224,000 jobs, and $3.7 billion in wages are being generated because of tourism. The sales tax and personal taxes coming into Minnesota coffers are huge. It's getting harder and harder to promote our area as a tourism destination with strict fishing regulations and a decrease in the number of resorts. Amazingly, the white deer have been a great promotional opportunity for us. We never know what a phenomenon we have until we hear it from our visitors. The sightings of the white deer are creating wonderful memories, and that's what tourism is all about, memories. These deer are not sick. They are awesome, and the Native Americans believe they are sacred. Why do we have so many of them? We don't know, but many visitors come to photograph, study, and admire them. Maybe they are a gift from God or the Great Spirit to unify our community. Please join us in our desire to protect these unique and beautiful creatures. In return, the white deer will delight generations to come and promote tourism to Minnesota.
How do you have so many of them? How many is so many of them?
There's probably a good dozen in our local area that we know of, but, you know, they come and go, and the predators get them also.
Okay. Mr. Kelleher. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, before Mr. Kelleher says his piece, I have signatures by 700 persons here from all over the state of Minnesota who, you know, have seen the white deer, especially at Father Hannigan. So
sounds like a transportation bill, all those things that Representative Emmer was waving. Ms. Kelleher, let's hear from you.
Complete agreement.
Plea agreement?
Yes.
Go ahead, sir. Welcome to the committee.
Good evening again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Kelleher. I'm here. Thank you.
That's good.
Very excellent. My name is Tom Kelleher. I'm here representing the Minnesota Dinners Association.
Mr. Kelleher, I'm going to hold this up while you're...
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure you can do it. And I'll hold the 17 calibers right next to
you. Yes.
We'll do that.
I've had the privilege of testifying on behalf of against this bill the last, if not every year, every other year for the last 12 years.
Uh-huh.
I represent the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. We are 20,000 members.
Members?
Yes. We have 68 statewide chapters. We had our annual convention this last weekend. We talked about 15 or 16 different issues before the legislature regarding deer and deer hunting in the outdoors. We spent about less than 90 seconds discussing this issue since it's been a past position of the Deer Hunters Association to oppose prohibitions on hunting of white deer. We consider them to be deer just like any other deer. I would make one contrary statement to the gentleman saying that they're special and unique. I think we would make an argument that they're odd and different and don't necessarily, as he said, live much past a certain young life because of predation and their own uniqueness as being an albino deer. The other issue is that this would just be Mille Lacs County. We've opposed this bill as a statewide bill in the past. I have had some discussions with some people about how do you determine if you're in Mille Lacs County or Kanawha County or one of the neighboring counties if you're on public land and you can't shoot it in Mille Lacs County, but you can shoot it in a neighboring county or harvest the deer, maybe I should say. So I think I'll just leave it at that, Mr. Chair. We've opposed this bill year in and year out, more or less. And you don't want to, we would prefer that the legislature not start segregating out different types of deer. There are red deer, there are piebald deer, there are black deer, there are, Mr. Chairman, you probably know more about this than I do. There are all kinds of varieties, subspecies of deer. Yes, there you
Well, so you would like the bill more than if on 9.17 we made eliminated the Mille Lacs County, a person may not take a white deer.
No, sir, we would oppose that as well.
I'm just checking. I want to make sure. Okay, Mr. Bogus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You are welcome. Always a pleasure. And what does the department have to say about this?
Mr. Chair and members, we do have some concerns about the bill. There's some confusion factors. First of all, Mille Lacs County is in 8 permit areas that we set up for deer. We don't follow county boundaries with permit areas. We generally follow highways or lakes or rivers or things like that. There's also degrees of white. There's albino deer, which is a true lack of pigment. They have the pink eyes, the pink noses, and all that.
An
albino. There's also white phase deer, it's a recessive phase, and then there's partially white deer that are called piebald deer. They have more of a Holstein sort of a look to them, and so there's some potential for varying degrees of whiteness in deer that could lead to some difficulties for hunters, or if it's low light conditions or things like that. Let's see, and then also the genetics of these deer, they're not as well adapted, that's why you don't tend to see them. And where you do tend to see some concentrations of white deer where you have a refuge type situation that's developed. There's some herds in other states where there hasn't been hunting or predation to speak of, and because these deer aren't as well adapted to survive, you can start to see this recessive sort of a genetic trait start to show up in those kinds of situations. And we probably have these deer in the numbers that they are due to some refuge situations with some of the state parks along the South Shore of Lake Mille Lacs, which has allowed them to persist despite a lack of protection, and there's a likelihood that they'll continue to persist in that area in the future. But those are a few of the concerns that we have, Mr. Chair and members.
Well, Mr. Bongus, back in the 90s, late 90s, a white bear showed up at the Vince Judy Wildlife Sanctuary.
Yes.
And the legislature passed a law that prohibited the taking of a white bear, as I remember.
Yes.
What was the position of the department on that particular piece of legislation? Do you recall that?
Mr. Chair, I do recall it, and if I'm correct, it was actually the DNR agreed to protect that bear with a rule rather than a law. And that was, a white bear is much more rare than a white deer. There was only one other area in North America where there were known to be white black bears, and we initially weren't enamored of protecting that bear either, but we became convinced it was a good idea. There could be some
similar famous bears, dancing bears. Okay, questions? Representative Simpson?
Just for my own well-being, I guess. Mr. Bogus, is there a reason, I mean, is there a genetic reason that you're opposed to it? Is there a reason other than the hassle of another?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simpson, we do have some concerns with the genetics that this would be favoring what's a less well-adapted genetic strain of deer. You know, how prevalent would that become in the population? I guess we don't know, but it would be giving extra protection to a genetic strain of deer that's less well-adapted to survive.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Being none, Representative Erickson, you want to have the last say on this bill? Well, I should ask, if there's anyone like testify for or against it, Colonel Hamm, did you have something you wanted to add to this? Doesn't look like it. Okay, Representative Erickson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee. I just wanted you to know that in an article that I pulled off the net on the 24th of February, which was just yesterday, that Lansing, Michigan thinks Minnesota already protects white deer. So I think it's a done deal.
Well, they're confused over that most of the time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
They want to be like Minnesota. Anyway, all right, thank you very much. We're going to hold the bill over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much. And we took off. I'm frankly confused by the other bill as well on the fish houses, even though I'm chief authoring it, that you asked me to, so we're going to work on it with the DNR.
Actually, the DNR likes the bill, but it's not the bill I intended.
No, I didn't think that it matched up with what you told me you were drafting. Okay, so we're laying that over. Now, Representative Westrom. House File 3079, we're going to lay over for possible inclusion. Representative Westrom, welcome to the committee and to your bill, House File 3079. One open season.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee member. This bill is a bill that was brought to my attention by a couple constituents asking me to consider writing legislation to modify the dates for spearing houses in northern Minnesota, and so hence the bill would give some flexibility to the DNR to remove the December 1st start date for spearing. And the idea of my constituents was to start it earlier. They are interested in spearing fish as a sport to get young people interested in and keep their interest, and expanding the season was one idea they had. Another idea they had, Mr. Chair, if members would be interested in it, but it's not part of this bill. I have another separate bill dealing with it, but their suggestion was to give a one-week license, free license, or a one-week opportunity for anybody under age 21 to here, and their suggestion was between December 26th and January 1st as a way to get people more interested in the opportunity as a young person, similar to take a kid fishing ideas, the idea they brought to my attention. And so two ideas, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to represent constituents of mine that in reading their letter and getting their input, I thought, I don't know why we couldn't try to make some accommodations like this. Steering, I have never done it, Mr. Chair, but you perhaps have, and I'm sure other committees members have, but I know people that have, and they really enjoy steering, and ultimately anything we can do to help foster the involvement and the interest of our citizens in the great outdoors, I'm in support of, and so I thought it would be worth drafting this bill and bringing their idea forward.
Representative Weston, thank you for the bill. It does occur. I live on, as you well know, I live on some pretty significant sized lakes.
I do.
And it does occur that from time to time there is adequate ice to spear and to have a house on the lakes prior to this date. I mean, it hasn't happened very recently, but in the last 30 years, I can think of many times when we traveled to and from my island, where I live on an island, as you know, and we could have easily had, by Thanksgiving, we were home by ATV or snowmobile, and we could have been spearing. So it's interesting, the bill. Does the department want to comment on the bill? They're coming down. Sorry. You're good where you're at, though. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Member John Player with DNR Fish and Wildlife. With the discretion that the department would have to open the season earlier, some of the concerns we would have would be just checking the lake. At what point would we determine whether or not weather conditions warranted? So we'd need to be checking lakes, different lakes, for ice thickness. So there'd be some concern there that if we opted to open the season earlier, what would be the criteria that we would actually use to do that? And then getting the information out to the people. We've had some issues getting information out to folks anyway. So some of the concerns we had were just checking all the lakes for the ice thickness to determine if they were safe, posting the lakes, or getting the word out that these lakes are open now.
Well, Ms. Fire, isn't the responsibility on ice safety that of the person who's trying to use it? And so what if we made the bill that it just said that the spearing season runs from November 15th
mm-hmm.
instead of December 1st? What would happen then?
Mr. Chairman, I think that would be an easier consideration than trying to determine on a year-to-year basis what weather conditions were. We haven't discussed in detail that option, but it would make more sense to me to look at that and just set the season earlier than to try each year to determine whether there were ice conditions that were safe. So we could take a look at how much earlier would make some sense to do that.
I'm really not familiar, except on the big lakes that you know I'm familiar with, where you would spear northerns. But I can think of, for example, on the Vermilion River. I'd be familiar with that. And many times by the 15th of November, that is more than adequate for travel on ice by the 15th. Now, that's a river, you know, a big wide river, and it freezes up way earlier than the big deep lakes. And there's a lot of northern in there, so you could technically spear. Representative Westrom, I'm just thinking that we're going to hold this bill over. I'd like you to consider just changing the date. And I saw Representative Cornish wagging his head yes, and so Representative Cornish would like to hear from you.
Yeah, I think it'd be a much better idea because it might put some liability, extra work, posting all that garbage on the DNR, just to open it up earlier. And some are going to argue a safety issue, but you've got boneheads out there now. No kidding, that on December 1st, I seen one pushing a fish out ahead of them with a cane pole with a life preserver on. And it was only this much ice. And so whatever season you set, there's going to be chances, so why put the liability on the DNR?
Well, I'd agree with you. Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that was a comment that I was going to make the same thing. But I would also say that if I hear any complaints, it seems like every year when we do our publications, you know, we'll do a typo or we'll put something in wrong that states the wrong date or or whatever it may be, and people get very confused on it. So I think doing a date specific would be a lot solider for the DNR.
Deputy Magner.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And somebody that grew up doing a lot of spearing when I was a kid, we did it along the shore, along the open water. We were falling in all the time. It didn't matter what time of the winter it was because the water was moving there. So, I mean, it was personal responsibility. My mom would say I didn't use it very well because I came home wet a lot. But I'm wondering, why do we even care on the front end? Let's just close it on the last day in February, and if they want to walk on the ice, they can walk on the ice whenever. Because we don't restrict when somebody puts a fishing house out, right? I mean, if they want to go fish sunnies on the 10th of November, and ice is strong enough, do we tell them they can't?
It's fire.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, one of the reasons would be statute currently dictates, I believe, that in order to spear whitefish, northern pike, or catfish, it has to be from a dark house. And so you could open it up earlier, and it probably wouldn't make any difference, but with that restriction, then you need to have ice at any rate.
Mr. Chair, but my point, the person in the ice house fishing for sunny is okay on the 10th of November, but somebody spearing for northern pike would not be, I think, is what you told me. So I guess, again, I don't even know why we would care on the front end.
No opening date. Well, and then how would you feel about that? I know that the propensity of having ice south of Highway 2 certainly wouldn't be that likely, but how would you feel about that versus statewide versus north of Highway 2? I frankly like north of Highway 2 on everything we do. Everything. Because, I mean, that's a whole other country up there. Kind of like Texas.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that'd be something that would be good to look at. There probably wouldn't be a reason to dissect a state like that. If we have just a little bit of time, we'd be more than happy to work with Representative Westrom and see if we could come up with something in terms of a firm date and whether it was north of 2 or statewide.
Hey, anyone to testify for or against the bill? It doesn't appear there will. Representative Westrom, I think you had a little chat with Mr. Bogus. I think we got an agreement in the making.
And Mr. Chairman, whatever that you want to do pertaining to the discussion is great with me. I think that's a good idea. I'm not sure what they do on December 1st if the ice isn't thick enough now, and so I think there's times around Alexandria that the week before Christmas the water's been open on unusual years. So I'm open to suggestions. It was brought to my attention, and I thought, I don't know why we do December 1st, and I'm learning as I sit here and listen. And
well, Representative Westrom, why don't you work with the DNR and get an amendment ready for the bill, and we'll talk about including it with the amendment.
Okay.
All right. I see Representative Junkie came in. I know Representative Mansell is waiting very patiently. Is it okay to do Representative Junkie? And his bill is 2640.
Representative Dill,
Chair
Dill.
Yeah.
Representative McNamara was asking me about how you really know if the ice is safe. And we kind of have a tradition in our country. We have a certain family that has been known over the years to drop 2-3 pickups in early. So we always figure when they drop a pickup in or don't drop one in, then it's safe for the rest of us to walk out.
Yeah, well, so, that happens around our house, too. And frankly, living on an island, Representative Simpson, in Crane Lake, nothing moves on the ice until I go home. And, I mean, then they figure, you know, as big as I am, it must be safe. So anyway, House File 2610, Representative Junkie, we're going to bring the bill before us for possible inclusion. Go ahead with the presentation on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Representative Hackbarth is very familiar with this because the House actually passed this bill a number of years back, but then Senator Marty was a little difficult, so we're hoping Senator Chaudhary will be a little more open-minded here. This is a good bill. It's a two-line fishing bill. Basically allows two-line fishing year-round in Minnesota rather than, as you know, we do it in the winter now in our holes in the ice. I handed out, so it's that simple, Mr. Chair. I handed out a sheet. These are all from the file when we passed before. It's a two-sided sheet that you're getting. And on one side, basically, are some positive talking points, if you will, And the other side has some suggestions, and I'm not sure the sheet is labeled that way, but there's three suggestions on one side, and there's talking points on the other. But while you're waiting for that, I would also then point out, and again, this is my research from Council of State Governments Midwest Office back when I did this bill in 2001, the first time I asked for this research. Just for your information, other states and their regulations, because we always wonder, what do other states do? Iowa, 2 lines. Kansas, 2 lines. Michigan, 3 lines for salmon and trout. North Dakota, 2 poles or lines. In the ice, it's 4 poles in North Dakota. In Nebraska, Mr. Chair, where you have a piece of property, 2 lines. In Ohio, 2 lines. I think you're getting the gist here. In South Dakota, 2 lines and 3 hooks per line. 4 lines may be used in the ice in South Dakota. Wisconsin at the time was 3 lines. I think they still are, but they're at least 2. And then there's some people that aren't our neighbors, California, Florida, New York, again, where they have fishing are either no regulation at all or 2 lines. So this is more the norm and not the exception, I would put to you. Now that you have your sheet, the one side that has all the points on it, I think, are good talking points and arguments and why we passed the bill to begin with. Again, this came, members, from my fishing community out in west central Minnesota, and our writers out there, fishing and hunting paper, newspaper people. Again, people, we keep talking about restrictions, cutting down on the limits, and it's always restrictions. This is a way to add to the enjoyment of the sport. Again, we need to remember the limit's the same. Doesn't matter how many lines you got in the water. It's still the same limit. The fish are biting, I would guarantee you, you will only be using one line because we've all fished and you can't reel in two. Once they start biting, you throw the other one in away. These are a lot of catch and release folks. Again, what you're looking at is just, they want to put a bobber out, and cast at the same time. It's something you can do, again, with kids. It's a big deal. Again, Minnesota is one of the few states. We already allow it on our border waters. We already do it in the summer on our border waters. So, again, not low. The tourism, our resorters were in favor of it. I haven't contacted them this year. But, again, they're competing with all the states I just talked to you about, particularly Wisconsin. So when people are deciding where they come fishing, if they can do in Wisconsin multiple lines, not Minnesota, Mr. Chair, you have a lot of resorts. I'd ask them what they think about it, but they have been very supportive in the past. Increased sale fishing equipment. Now you can hook 2 lines on the rocks and even lose more equipment, so it helps in that part.
You've done a wonderful job.
You love that?
You've done a good job at promoting this bill now, so I want to hear a couple of
questions. But I want to give one more on the other side of the sheet, and this is what the committee should look at more, Mr. Chair.
I'm looking at it.
Is there's also an opportunity for a surcharge for this, and other states do charge that. So when you're looking for additional revenue, you could get a $4 or $6 surcharge. And again, my folks out in West Central Minnesota said they'd be willing to pay that for the opportunity. So again, it can be a money raiser too. I got lots of others. So I got a whole file full of stuff here. So if you want any more information,
we're
going to
ask a couple
bill.
Of questions. Representative Simpson.
I think, Mr. Chair, we discussed this quite thoroughly here 2 years ago, and it seems at that time that the biggest concern was the fact that we're trying to maintain our fish population, and this would probably take advantage of that population. We're looking at decreasing limits, and at this time, I just don't know that this is the right direction to go, but that's just my opinion.
Anyone else? Oh, hi, Representative Bagan.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Chair, the question I have about this is, so if I'm fishing and somebody in the boat has 2 lines and the DNR is going around, they'll have to now, if they can see that I have the 2 lines, the DNR will have to come and approach the boat to make sure that I, is there some sort of license or some sort of permission? So you're considering a blanket.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Bingham, the way the bill is set up, it's just 2 lines. You can have up to 2 lines, just like you do in the winter. So there's nothing to check. If you add a surcharge to make money,
then
you, just like you check to see if someone has a pheasant stamp, if they have a small game license, you have to check to see if they paid the additional money to do the additional thing. So again, I'd remind Representative Simpson, there's no difference in the limits. Mr. Chair, I'm just going to read one. I'll quit then. But the real report you might be interested in, you might have heard of that. It's from Baudette, I believe, and they write an outdoor column called The Real Report. And Jerry Vannis up there in his column about this last time I was here said, if fish finders, GPS units, and underwater video cameras haven't endangered our fish population, I cannot see where a person using two lines would have a detrimental impact either.
From the department. Anyone have been, want to talk about this, Mr. Clark? Welcome again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, Ron Fire with DNR Fish and Wildlife. And the concerns that we've had is that we as fish managers try to strike the balance between numbers and quality of fish. The average size of quite a number of our major game fish species has declined over the past 40 years. There's been a number of studies. That was kind of the genesis of the fishing roundtable, is to reverse that trend. Got a lot of awfully good anglers out there right now that can target fish. It's pretty clear based on the places that do have two lines that it would increase harvest. And so I think the trade-off that anglers need to consider is whether or not a potential decline in average size, not able to reverse that trend, potential increase in the number of experimental regulations and regulation complexity is something that would be desirable. We've just made some changes in bag limits. We'd have to address lakes like Mille Lacs and Red where there's quotas on there, then this could substantially increase. And to the point on limits, I think that limits aren't that effective of a tool in terms of, for example, for walleye, if we reduce the limit by one, you'd reduce the potential harvest by 2.8%. If you reduced it by two, 6.7%. If you reduced it by three, 13.5%. The point there is most people aren't taking their limit of fish, so two lines would increase the harvest on that. So I think that's the trade-off that would need to be considered in terms of the average size and whether or not we would maybe want to move down the path towards more restrictive regulations if we wanted to retain the quality that our anglers are looking for.
And again, Mr. Chair, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but ever since this bill was introduced, I've yet to have the department come and tell me that Minnesota's fishery will be lessened based on our neighbors to the east, Wisconsin, which has just as many lakes and does the multi line. So what you're saying then, I assume, is that Wisconsin's fishery is in trouble, it's not maintained, and the numbers of fish have decreased dramatically using two or three lines in Wisconsin, yet I've seen no evidence of that, Mr. Chair, ever. It's all summation and maybe this and maybe that. Which is why, again, we passed it last time. Again, I'll thank Representative Hackbarth for his help on the floor, actually, at that point. And like I say, it's hard to find anyone other than the DNR that questions this.
Okay, Representative Hackbarth, anything you want to mention on this?
Good bill, include it.
Okay, anything else, Representative Jonke?
Now I got to go to bonding committee and work on all your projects.
Oh, thank you.
Does that help
much.
My bill? No.
I like it.
Representative Mansell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Environment. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Okay, the chair will move House File 3328 to be recommended to pass and referred to the Environment Policy Committee. Representative Mansell, through your bill.
Joining me is familiar face Marty Vadas, Director of Lands and Minerals. 3328 puts into state statute what is commonly called around here the Forest Legacy Program. We create what will be called the Minnesota Forest for the Future Program, and it's absolutely critical in both northern Minnesota with large tracts of land and in southern and central Minnesota with smaller tracts of land that are vulnerable to private development. Three goals. Sustainable, manageable forests for production, public recreational spaces, including motorized access, and wildlife habitat spaces. With that, that's the bill, that's what it does, and we'll stand for questions.
Questions from the membership? Being none, Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, President Manziel. When you say motorized access, are you I see snowmobiles on the front cover of this, but are you talking about other types of motorized access also?
Representative Manziel.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hackbarth, I mean motorized access, including ATVs, snowmobiles, and other forms of motorized recreation.
Thank you very much.
Questions further? Anyone for or against? I'm getting the up sign from Commissioner Meyer. Mr. Vadas, Director Vadas, do you have any comments on this bill?
Mr. Chairman, I just mentioned that this bill is really a product of a DNR advisory team that has met for about 6 months here and had broad representation from some NGOs, local government that was co-chaired by the chair of the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association and the Grand Rapids Area Chamber of Commerce. And so a group has been working hard over the last 6 months to try to put together the bill that you have in front of you that would establish this this program for Minnesota.
Okay. Any further questions or comments? Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hanzo, is there a cost of this, or who's going to monitor this, and what kind of a cost of old room?
Mr. Chair and Representative Simpson, my understanding is that there's no cost involved with this legislation.
Mr. Meyer.
Always the cost.
There's always the cost.
Mr. Chairman, members, I was going to see if I could move the whole meeting without being up here, but
we couldn't live without you. You'll see on the bill on section subdivision 12 beginning on line 3.14, we talk about monitoring, enforcement, and damages, where the commissioner shall establish a long-term program for monitoring and enforcing Minnesota's forests for the future easements. Currently, we are monitoring and enforcing these easements right now under our existing FTE complement, our staff for our Forest Legacy Program. It is a yearly monitoring program. We also do have many people that are on these easements, sometimes on a daily or weekly or monthly basis at least, so we are monitoring these very closely. Easement monitoring and enforcement is something that we are very concerned about and do support. We're working with other members and other committees on language throughout the legislature to deal with other easement enforcement and monitoring issues. So on these Forest Legacy easements, we're dealing with our current FTE complement.
Thank you.
Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Meyer, can you point out in the bill exactly where it says that motorized recreation is going to be included?
Mr. Meyer. Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Hackbarth, if you see under, beginning on subdivision 3 under the establishment, land selected for inclusion, 1.20, after the period, land selected for the inclusion of the program shall be evaluated for the land's potential for timber, maintaining forest landscape, providing public recreation, the eligibility that is out there, land interest application. It doesn't specifically say that there will be access on there, but one of the things we are purchasing on these easements are the traditional access routes that are there. If there is a grant and aid trail, we are securing those rights so we do not lose those opportunities, and also working with the landowner on a case-by-case basis to, where applicable, secure new recreational opportunities. Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Representative Hanzel, then I don't feel very comfortable with this bill and your statement that motorized recreation is included, because it doesn't specifically say that. And according to Mr. Meyer, it does not include that.
Well, Representative Hackbarth, I think you asked, does the intent of the bill?
No, I asked where it was.
Oh, okay, I thought
that
you said
it specifically
intent.
Said that motorized recreation is going to be allowed on this land.
All right.
And that's what I want to know.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Gunther, Hackler, it was my understanding that the term public recreation means recreation available to all stakeholders.
Well, I've been down this road. Mr. Chairman, I've been down this road many times. And Representative Anzell, it does not.
Are you proposing an amendment?
I would propose an amendment, Mr. Chairman. Maybe I could get help from House Research on how to do that and include motorized recreation, including all-terrain vehicles and off-road motorcycles.
It's on line 3 where it says and.
Including, yeah, that might be my amendment, if that's all right with House Research. Including all-terrain vehicles and off-road motorcycles.
So where would you insert that, Representative Simpson?
On line 124, after the word and. Providing public recreation and.
Representative Anzell. Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Meyer.
Representative Hackbarth, on your amendment, perhaps it might be more appropriate to say motorized and non-motorized recreation, unless you want to be specific to those classes.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I do want to specifically make sure that ATVs and off-road motorcycles are included, because sometimes when we're talking about motorized vehicles, we're only talking about including snowmobiles. And I'm all for including snowmobiles also, but I want to make sure that off-road motorcycles and ATVs are included.
Well, so
I'm okay with providing public recreation and just saying after recreation, including ATVs, snowmobiles, off-road motorcycles, whatever you want to say there, whatever the amendment might do, but I specifically want to include those.
Yep.
Because it can be interpreted different ways, and I've been down that road, Mr. Meyer, and Representative Anzell, I've been there.
Okay, House, Ms. Taylor, can you, you have
Chairman.
Language? Representative Peterson, just one moment.
Then I guess if we're going to go down that road, I'd like it to say, cross-country skiing, snowshoeing, walking, and anything else involved with public recreation as well.
Well, then we could put non-motorized recreation.
Yeah.
Okay. It's actually Representative Hackbarth's amendment, if he's willing to. We're kind of developing it here on the fly.
Absolutely. Non-motorized recreation. All non-motorized recreation also.
So why don't we, do we have any other, while you're working on this, we'll give you a moment. Mr. Vegas.
Mr. Chair, I'd just point out that this issue did come up during that advisory group meeting that I talked about. And I think the consensus there was that historic use of the land for that purpose ought to be included in these easements. But I'll just point out the fact that this covers all of Minnesota, not just northern Minnesota. And there are potentially easements that will be taken on very small parcels in southern Minnesota, say 5 acres in size. And so just the implications that it's a requirement that motorized use be provided for all of these might be an issue, especially some of those southern Minnesota ones where they could potentially even be landlocked, where the public doesn't have an opportunity to use the parcel in that.
Representative Anzell.
Mr. Chairman and members, I would just add to this discussion that our citizens get frustrated and deeply resentful when they find out that public dollars are being used for programs such as Forest Legacy, and then somebody decides that one group or another of citizens can't use the recreation that they choose to use. And I just think that if public dollars are going to be involved in the program, we ought to go the extra mile to make recreation available to everyone.
And Representative Anzell, I think that goes to Representative Hackbarth's idea and Representative Peterson's idea, that I would agree with Representative Hackbarth that we have been down this road before.
Yep.
And we have been on both sides of the issue. We have had sometimes when we prevailed and sometimes when we lost. Seems like more times we lose than we prevail. So I am I encourage the development, and if we could listen to some language that you could possibly give us now. Ms. Taylor.
Dear Mr. Chair, members, on line 1.24, after recreation, insert comma, including non-motorized and all motorized vehicle use, comma, including all-terrain vehicles, comma, off-road motorcycles, comma, and snowmobiles.
Representative Hackbar.
Mr. Chairman, I'm okay with that. But I do want to point out, too, in the subdivision 3, it says land selected for inclusion in the program shall be evaluated on the land potential for. So it doesn't say that I have to have this. So if there are 5-acre parcels that we're going to consider for this, all we're saying here is that we're looking at the potential for these different things.
Meet your expectation,
Representative, I think we're just, this is like, do it on the fly, you know, do you have your list complete? What about somebody, like, hook up their skis to a kite? You know, it's something I haven't even thought of yet. You know, you put on these lists of these activities with these large public domain things. I don't think we should mess with Representative Van Zyl's bill right now. I just made a suggestion. I just really don't think we should be messing with it.
Well, the chair doesn't agree with that. I'd be willing to work on some additional language to try and make this right. I just know that I seem to be on the losing end of this, and Representative Van Zyl, if you want to comment on that.
Not to belabor the point, Mr. Chairman and members, but all of the groups need to have confidence in the negotiations process, in the process where there are some people at the table negotiating the terms and conditions for how the public can use these parcels. And not everybody is specifically at that table. And we just have to hope that everybody's interest is taken into account in the negotiation process. That becomes problematic when groups of citizens feel that they're being shut out of the process. And last year we had a heck of a time guaranteeing motorized access in the first 52,000-acre parcel. And it was only through some great work done by the DNR and a few other people that we were able to dodge that bullet and make that available to people. And I'd like to prevent that acrimony from continuing each time another parcel is up for negotiation.
Representative Van Zyl, your position on the amendment.
I support the amendment.
Representative Hackbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that amendment, and I thank Representative Van Zyl for his support and for your support, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hackbar moves the amendment. If you'd repeat it to us again, Ms. Taylor, so we know we got the right thing.
Mr. Chair and members, on line 1.24, after recreation, insert comma, including non-motorized and all motorized vehicle use, comma, including all-terrain vehicles, comma, off-road motorcycles, comma, and snowmobiles.
And Representative Hackbar, I think I would make a minor change to
that. Right. I would like to move that all, the word all, to all non-motorized and eliminate it from the area where you have it, yeah, where it says all motorized.
Yeah. All
so
non-motorized.
You could read it one more time.
Could you read it one more time so we have it right?
On line 1.24, after recreation, insert comma, including all non-motorized and motorized vehicle use, comma, including all-terrain vehicles, comma, off-road motorcycles, comma, and snowmobiles.
That sounds much better.
President Peterson.
I have a question, but
I'm calling on you, assuming you have a question.
Oh, thank you. That's what Knuth does, though. So is that the entire list? What about go-karts or, you know, something like that? I mean, if you're going to list 3 types of vehicles, what if there's more than 3?
Mr.
You know what I mean?
To that point, I think go-karts would probably be under motorized. And
well, yeah.
Non-motorized, I think that would be your kite with your skis.
Right.
So I think you're broadening the base pretty well with the language that she's come up with.
Then, Mr. Chairman, why list the 3 if it's just all motorized?
Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Peterson just asked the question. If we have all motorized and non-motorized, I don't see, you would comfort certain groups, but all non-motorized and motorized includes all the things we've listed, and I don't really see the point of adding the list to the amendment.
Representative Hackbar.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, I see Mr. Potter in the audience, so maybe we could have him come forward.
Mr. Potter.
When you talk about snowmobiles are in a different area of law,
than ATVs and off-road motorcycles are. And I think they fall under a different classification. That's why I have them included.
I thought Mr. Potter was here. I called on him and I don't see him. Oh, here he comes. All right, Mr. Potter. You are being called upon.
You're correct.
Representative Ackbar, do you have a question for Mr. Potter?
Isn't it true that snowmobiles fall in a different area of law than ATVs and off-road motorcycles? Because when you talk about motorized recreation, some of those are included in motorized recreation and some are not. Maybe you could give us that definition of why they're kind of, they're different somehow.
Ms. Potter.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hackworth, it falls into our definition of a motor vehicle. Motor vehicle does not include snowmobile, but includes everything else. So it's just in that one particular case, and we use that definition quite often, but it does not include snowmobile.
Further discussion on the Hackbarth Amendment. Representative Knuth.
If you could, thank you, Mr. Chair. If you could clarify, the motorized recreation, what is that defined in statute, or what does that, is it defined in statute?
Mr. Chairman, motorized recreation, I don't recall a definition in statute that would define that specifically.
Representative Hackbarth.
Mr. Chairman, I think Mr. Potter explained it pretty well that I think we're kind of keeping the four-wheel drive truck out of this, is the amendment that I put forth. I included the two, the off-road motorcycles and the ATVs, specifically so we could include those. I didn't say all motorized vehicles, as per the definition that Mr. Potter told us. And then I also want to include snowmobiles because they don't fall in there. So I think we made it pretty clear. But I think what this does is it does not include the four-wheel drive trucks, and I don't think anybody wants to include those.
Okay, further discussion on the amendment. To the author, any further discussion? Okay, in favor of the Hackbarth Amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, Representative Anzell, 3328 is amended. Do you have any other testifiers?
No, I don't.
Anyone for or against the bill as amended? Okay, we're going to vote to move the bill out of here to Environment Policy. Renew my motion to send it to Environment Policy. All in favor, say aye.
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 And opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, what are we doing next? All right. Okay, I've got a stack of bills here. We're going to try and go through them as quickly as we can to get people out. We may not take up every one of them tonight because we went a little long on the aquaculture bill. So since we're not taking votes or anything on the bills, I'll just move the bill to bring it before us for possible inclusion. House File 2871. Members, this has to do with the establishment of a conservation license. As you can see, it makes the conservation license available to all kinds of different residents, non-residents, individuals, so on and so forth. And it makes a daily possession limit of one half of the daily possession limit on all fish taken under the standard angling license, rounded to the next whole number if necessary. And the last item is the fee. The fee shall be two-thirds of the corresponding standard angling license. So if it was $10, then you'd have two-thirds of that license, and you get half the number of fish. The idea behind this is... I got this idea, frankly, from being fishing in Canada all the time. They have a conservation license. I mean, we go on, Representative McNamara, you and I have been on a fishing trip in Canada. We bought conservation licenses. We caught all the fish we wanted. We ate all the fish while we were there that we wanted. At least you probably did. And
remember, I can't eat them. I'm allergic.
That's right. And I don't eat them because I'm sick of them. So anyway, that's where I got the idea from. And I just think it's kind of a way to start the process
of thinking about conservation, and so that's the genesis of the bill. Representative Hackbar?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You anticipated my question. Maybe something we could consider if this bill moves forward is dedicating just this license money to maybe stocking or something like that. You might be something you might want to think about.
Okay. Any other discussion on the bill? Anyone from the department? Ms. Byer? And I'll have to tell you, members, I don't think we're done with the bill yet. This is a starting point.
Mm-hmm. Good idea.
Mr. Chairman, members, Ron Player with Minnesota DNR Fish and Wildlife. And, you know, the concept of improving and increasing opportunities for recreational fishing and building an ethic to release some fish is a good one, and it might draw some more people in. Our concern has always been the financial impact, and based on the Ontario experience, somewhere around 50% of the licenses are conservation licenses. And so just extrapolating those numbers, you might be looking at something, and we haven't done a fiscal analysis yet, but probably in the $2 to $4 million range in terms of reduced revenue. And so that's our primary concern with the bill.
Okay, well, I heard a conversation with a high-ranking department spokesman, boss that said nobody buy the license in the first place. So it'll be interesting to see how that fiscal note's going to show up over here at the committee. Representative Simpson.
Mr. Payer, would that number, was that based off of out-of-state purchases, or was that based off of local purchases?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simpson, the information that I had was from 99. Ontario implemented their conservation license in 1993, and at that point in time it was 50% of the resident sales were conservation licenses and 45% of the non-resident sales were conservation licenses, so at that point in time roughly half of each.
And to that point, do we have a figure? I'm sure you have a number that we take in out-of-state non-resident license. Would that change that? I think you'd see a change, but I think one of the things that I see in my area, I have a lot of North Dakota residents that own cabins, and they're going to buy a full license. They wouldn't buy a conservation license, I don't think, because they're going to buy a season license. So kind of keeping that in mind, do you think that would be as great a drop for us as it would be for Canada?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simpson, I'm not sure. Minnesota has party fishing, and so you might see an increased number of folks picking up a conservation license. And what Ontario recommended, they said it works where you can catch a lot of fish, where you're going to get your limit just about every time. It'll have an effect. People that want to come in and take fish home probably would buy the full license, but people that are already releasing their fish would likely purchase a conservation license. So that's why the range somewhere in that $2 to $4 million range, we wouldn't know until it was implemented to see who was purchasing the license.
Okay, thank you.
All right, any other questions on the bill? Okay, we'll lay that one over. Thank you very much. As I said, I don't think we're done with that yet. We've still got a few things to work on. The next bill is 2930. Same game plan here to lay it over. The bill has to do with bear hunting. And in case of the drawing, the commissioner shall allow a person to apply for a permit in more than one area, essentially rank their area. And the person applying for the permit shall submit the applicable license fee, which is, I believe, not the way we're doing it now. We're issuing we're telling them they get the permit and then collecting the fee. And one of the arguments by the bear hunting group is that people are asking for the permit and they get the permit and then they don't go through with the permit for one reason or another, so then they don't buy the permit and we end up not selling the license even though we went through the process of giving them. Of going through the process. That was the way it was explained, right? Okay? And so if a person is not selected for the hunting permit, the person may elect to have the license fee refunded or held for a future permit. Representative McNamara.
Well, Mr. Chair, do we not, when we apply for a bear permit, it's not like a turkey permit where we have to pay a $3 fee?
Mr. Boggess.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, for deer and bear, there was a dollar added to licenses like 30 years ago that covered the electronic licensing process, so there's not a separate application fee for bear like there is for turkey and some of the others.
So, Mr. Boggess, the person, make sure I understand it properly, the person can apply for the permit, not pay for the permit, then they get drawn for the permit, and then not actually buy the permit. And so that would use up a permit. It reminds me of the Boundary Waters. We have folks up at the Boundary Waters getting permits to keep people from going in there. I mean, they actually pay, you know, apply for permits, so they get the permit, and then they never go there. And so then no one can go in there. It's the same problem here, Mr. Parr.
Mr. Chair, you're correct. They could do that, but we each year look at the percentage of people who were drawn who actually purchased permits, and it runs like, I don't know what the most recent number would be, but it's around 85% of the people who are drawn actually buy the license, and we factor that into the quota, so we inflate the quota right now. If they had to pay in advance, you know, the quotas probably wouldn't be as high as they are now.
Mr. McNamara.
Well, Mr. Chair, I know you're laying it over, but I would look at the example of the turkey. I think it's $3 that we do on the turkey license, and then maybe it would cover if there's some extra costs. Because to give more flexibility, and bear hunting happens to be controversial, I really don't want people pulling the permits because they don't agree with the hunting, just so we don't get to use it.
I think, Mr. Chair, members, I think it's a good idea if you make them pay the whole boat and make them make up their mind. If they're going to put in for the permit, they should go hunting. And if they have to pay for it, they're more likely to go. So hit them for the whole amount when they're successfully drawn or they don't get one. Otherwise, you got them either not hunting or they go out and baiting. And they start baiting. If they don't get a bear, then they don't buy their license. And so you hit them up with it right away. And
well, is the tape on? Because I'd like to make sure that's on the record that you and I agree on something. I want to make sure I've got that one. Anyway, more questions on the bill? Okay, thanks very much, Fire. We'll lay that one over. The next one is, might as well stay up here. I know you're going to have a comment on this one, too, Mr. Fire. Master Bear, House File 3275, we're going to lay that over for possible inclusion. This has to do with the Master Bear Guide License and rulemaking. What we've got here is that the bear hunters have said that they want to have a guide license that allows others to bait bear under them being supervised by those folks that need to bait being supervised by them, by the bear guide, the Master Bear Guide. What this does is establish that kind of a license, increase the fee to $330 to cover all four people, and give that opportunity. Mr. Boggess.
Mr. Chair, the way we read your bill, it's no cut in price. It's just putting three or four actually guides under one license. And I know we've been working with the bear guides on some proposed rule changes to try to make sure there are some standards that they have to meet to be guides and so forth. I'm assuming, but I'm not sure because we didn't get a chance to talk about this bill ahead of time, that you may be anticipating that when we have these higher standards for guides, that the master guiding license holder would have to meet those criteria, but the ones working under that license maybe would have a little less standards. Right now we really don't have standards that we hold guides to, but we are working on and have been for some time some potential rules that would require those standards. So I'm guessing you're anticipating that when that day comes that we have those rules.
This is the time and place. We're getting ready. This, remember, every one of these bills that we're hearing has basically come from the round table. where people stood up and said, this is a problem, we're trying to find a solution. And you know, maybe we won't have every solution for every problem, but Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chairman, I did look over that close. Now, with this, if they got the master bear license, how many people would they be able to put under them the master bear license?
Three additional,
okay.
Yep, and we're charging them four times the fee. So if they're not getting a free lunch here. Okay, any other, anyone else like to testify for or against? Okay, we'll lay this over for possible inclusion. Oh, we got way too many. These aren't all mine, surely to God. Oh, this is, okay, so House File 3282, we're going to lay that over for possible inclusion. That's also a bill. This came from Senator Saxog, didn't it? Yeah, from over in Saxog. Section 1 is about a horse bath. Apparently there's a problem out there with somebody riding their horse on their own land that happens to be a horse trail, a state horse trail. So we had the same problem, Representative Hackbarth would remember, that we had the same problem with a snowmobile, someone riding their snowmobile on their own private land, but yet they granted a permit for a grant-made snowmobile trail to go across there. And so then you got, you know, a question of whether they're doing it legally. They needed, someone challenged him and said, you need a trail permit to ride on that trail. And he goes, wait a minute, it's my own land. Well, the way that I understand the previous law was that they did need a trail permit. We fixed that. This does the same thing. Also, it says that, isn't this also has the part in there about the, this now makes it so that it would be immediately available in your possession rather than on the, visibly display it on the horse's tack or on your person. So this would mean that it would be like a fishing license. You could have it in your pocket because you're not licensing the horse, as I understand it. You're licensing the person. So it would be like a fishing license or a hunting license. So that's number one, the first part of the bill. Any questions on that part? Seems to be kind of common sense to me. Representative McNamara?
Well, no, I think I'm farther down. I'm not seeing much about horses once we get so far down.
Well, I mean, we're on section one still. Yeah. McNamara.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. And then Section 2, that amends the statute to establish a $52 resident license fee for an all-firearms license fee for an all-firearms license to take two deer throughout the state, subject to restrictions to prevent over-harvest and to improve distribution by hunters. And so... that is in Section 2. Mr. Kelleher, you have a comment on that?
Good evening again, Mr. Chair. Excuse me.
Go ahead.
And members of the committee. As I said earlier, Tom Kelleher with the Minnesota Journalists Association. As I stated earlier, we had our corporate board meeting this past weekend. Two things about this particular bill. In regards to the $52 all firearms license, we seem to be supportive of that. We have so many now different categories of licenses, I think we sort of thought, like, well, why not this one too? And in regards to scopes with muzzleloaders, which you'll get to, I think, Mr. Chair, we have a board position in support of scopes on muzzleloaders, contrary to what some members of the Senate may have thought last year.
Well, we were going to get to that next time, but I wanted to ask Mr. Bogus what the department's position is on the $52 gun license.
Mr. Chair, we like the concept. As we mentioned to you briefly, we're working on a deer simplification amendment that we convened a committee in late 2007 and last month to look at simplifying the deer regulations, and we've got another idea that we're potentially going to bring to you and to Senator Saxog that could accomplish the same thing and maybe consolidate a number of licenses into just a few and potentially allow for what you're trying to do with this license and also reduce the complexity of the regulation.
The time is now and the place is here, so it's got to happen soon. And I think that lobbyist Kelleher will be in agreement with what they're bringing forward. Have you talked to them about this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just heard about it in sort of global terms.
Yep.
I've heard it described that way. And in regards to the caliber discussions that we had earlier, I had heard that some folks are talking about limiting all the caliber restrictions for big game and leave it up to the hunter to determine if it's an appropriate weapon to harvest the deer.
Okay. And then any questions? Representative McNamara.
Well, I like the idea. I'm assuming, Mr. Boggs, you're talking about where it'd just be, it'd be $27, and that's what it would be, and it would have the same effect as this, I'm thinking. Right now we're stuck, I shouldn't say stuck, but we have the opportunity to buy it at the $72 one's the only way we do it. Or whatever, however it goes, and it allows those to bow hunt too. I like the idea of simplifying it. And truthfully, Mr. Keller, you put a completely different spin on the earlier, and that's a legitimate discussion. If you want to have the idea to let anybody, I think just call a spade a spade. If you're going to have them out using those rifles to shoot deer, that's a different point than say we're going to allow somebody to be under the auspices of coyote hunting with a rifle. That would be my only point. So,
and, Mr. Chair, I think the distinction too of what Mr. Boggs is talking about and what I mentioned earlier is that the all-season license today comes with three tags, and the license you're describing, I believe, also comes with two tags.
Two tags.
Yeah. And that's something we support, at least in the current framework of the numbers, the population of the deer herd.
Okay. Any further questions on these sections? Okay. And the last item is additional bear hunting permits. this would allow for the Natural Department to may issue its permissive language up to 10 additional bear hunting permits for promotion of scientific, conservation, or educational purposes. Mr. Boggess, I need to know some more information on that part. Is that a department deal, or is that, where are we at on that?
Mr. Chair and members, this idea came up last year where there's some groups that want to have hunters be able to come in and have some assurance of that they will be able to hunt. And so they suggested that the language like this might be able to provide that assurance. We had concerns about this just because right now we have a preference system that's based on the number of times people have applied and not been drawn. Everybody takes their turn getting to the front of the line to get a permit, and this would basically provide some additional permits that could be auctioned off or something like that for promotion of scientific, conservation, or education purposes. But,
Mr. Boggess, do we do this with anything else? Deer hunting, duck hunting, whatever kind of hunting we have in Minnesota, or fishing? Do we auction off any kind of anything else that you know of?
Mr. Chair, not that I'm aware of. And just along the lines of this, since this came up last year, we are pursuing some rulemaking that would, at least we're talking about pursuing some rulemaking that would allow a person to apply for preference. Right now, a lot of our bear hunting zones you get drawn every year, but there are some where it's only like a 2 out of 3 chance of being drawn. So if you and I put in for a permit, I might get drawn and you might not. If we both want to be sure of being drawn, we could either do it as a party or one of us could apply for preference, and so that the next year we both know that we could for sure be drawn. And so we are looking at making our system a little more predictable. Even if you're not in a party, you can put in for preference and then know for sure that the next year you'd be drawn. So we think that this part of the reason that we've been told that this they're interested in this language is for predictability of being able to hunt. And so we're working on some modifications to the drawing that would still have people take turns, but they could decide to sit out a year basically while still moving up in line.
Okay. Anyone have any comment on that section? Okay. Thank you very much. We'll lay the bill over, 3282. We'll lay it over for possible inclusion.
Chair.
Representative Magmar.
No discussion about the muzzle loaders and the scope?
I'll be glad to do that. I thought we had moved past that. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. No.
No, that's all right. If you'd like to discuss it, that's fine. The bill is laid over for inclusion. You'd like to have a higher power scope, or how would you like to handle that?
No, I don't like it, but that's okay.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
As long as we're on that issue, I would like to talk about it a little bit, just to refresh people's memories, and we've been down this road before too, Mr. Chairman. Scopes on muzzleloaders. You can use a scope on a muzzleloader now.
Yep.
If you want to hunt with a muzzleloader during the regular firearm season. And you can use a scope. The season that's been established for muzzleloaders and flintlocks or the special season that we have was developed for those folks that want to do some primitive style hunting. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't meant to be an extra deer hunting season for these new rifled muzzleloaders that we have. And I don't have a problem with the rifle itself, and if people want to use that for deer hunting, that's fine, and we have provisions for that, and you can do that during the regular firearm season. But I don't know why we have a special season that now these folks are going to be included in using scopes and muzzleloaders. I don't think that's right, and I've always been against it, but that's just my opinion. I wanted to refresh people's memory of why we have a special, separate muzzleloader, flintlock type season, and it was for primitive style hunting. It wasn't meant for a special rifle muzzleloader scope season.
Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment or two on this also. I actually carried this bill a few years ago, and at that time the primitive hunters, as Representative Hackbart talked about, were quite concerned about it. But I think things have changed a lot in just a short period of time with the new inline, muzzle loaders that are out there. And I have a lot of people in my area that are muzzle hunting, and I've had more people talk to me about scopes on muzzle loaders than I have any other topic of sporting events. So there seems to be a real high demand for it. I think they feel that there would be a higher kill rate and a less chance of getting missed shots, or damaging shots, not getting the kill. So.
Anyone else? Representative Cornish?
I'll wait till the bill. You're going to just hold it over anyway. I'll do all my arguing in the interim. I don't like it either.
All right. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to go by.
Well, are we going
to
hold it over?
Yeah, we're holding it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Vetri and I didn't really focus in on it, to this degree. But I'm glad to know where we're at on that. I know it's been I didn't actually author the bill. I mean, I authored the bill, but I mean, SACDOG sent it over to me to get it in play so we could discuss it. And so with that, we'll bring 3283. This is a little more complicated of a bill than the last one, and this is what would be we're going to hold this over for possible inclusion as well. What we're trying to do here is to establish that the youth firearms for big game hunting is similar to or the same as for small game hunting, including no fee under the age of 16. Now, I know the DNR is going to have some comment on this, so Mr. Bogus, are you going to be talking about this, or who is going to do that? And this came to us from the Deer Hunters Association and from the roundtable. I'm sorry, I couldn't get it out. And so if you look at it, says the first thing, Subdivision 3 says a resident under age 16 may obtain a small game license to take. And the reason we want to have that is because right now you don't have to get a small game license to hunt if you're under age 16. This license would be free. But what we do is we start to get a handle on how many kids we actually have out there under the age of 16, because when we heard from the department, they said that they didn't know those numbers. So this would be a free license. If your child is 16 or under, they would go to the ELS and get a license. It would be free to them. We would know that they're out there hunting. The next changes are over on Section 2. It says a resident under the age of 16 may obtain a license without paying a fee. That's the part I was just referring to. Buy a firearm or bow if the resident is, and then it tells the changes. And you can read those for yourself. And then non-residents under the age of 18 would be handled in the same way. So, Mr. Bogus, what do you? I know we talked briefly about this
in before we had the hearing, before we came in here today.
Mr. Chair, I guess we were not sure at first exactly what you were trying to do with the small game hunters. We understand now you're just trying to get us a better handle on how many of those under 16 are actually hunting small game by having them get a free license. So that was just one of the questions that we had on what you were trying to do. And then wasn't clear to us if you were also trying to get rid of the minimum age for hunting deer, and we understand now that is your intent, as long as they're accompanied. And so at this point, we haven't had a chance to talk any further. I'm not sure if Colonel Hamm or his firearm safety instructors have looked at this and have any position, but we were just trying to get a better understanding of what the chair was trying to do with the bill, and we need to have some more discussion.
Representative Simpson, did you have a question?
No, not at this time. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Colonel Hamm?
Chair, I certainly think that we would be able to work with you on this. I think that we would want to make it clear. When I read the summary, it said that it requires them to get the license, and when you read the language, it says they may obtain a small game license, and may sometimes lean towards they may opt out of that. But I do certainly see the direction that you're going, and it still would require the same firearm safety requirements that we have out there right now. So
I agree that we probably should change that to shall.
I think fine-tuning this to get where the officer wants to get would be a good thing, for sure.
Well, I had a question then to either of you. How does that play out for the need for identification when you get a license? A social security number as an example. If we issue a license, do they have to? I'm trying to think back of when Representative Hackbarth was the chair and we dealt with this issue. When they issue a license, do you have to have a social security number? Or that's the first question. If it's free, you understand where I'm going with the question.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we did. That question came up this afternoon. At some point, we do need to collect that Social Security information to comply with the federal child support laws and so forth. But I'm not sure at what age that kicks in, and we need to check on that.
Okay, could you get Mr. Kudelka in the loop on that as we're working forward on the bill?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And further comment on the bill, Representative Colonel Hamm?
Mr. Chair and members, to the point on the Section 2 and Section 3 where you're talking about the big game, just so that the chair and the committee members are aware of the way that this is written, under current law, anybody that is under the age of 12, if they turn 12 during the firearm season, there's been some changes with 11-year-olds turning 12 for qualifications on deer license, but this is to the point of those that are 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, some rather young ages. This is now saying that those folks, if they are accompanied by a parent or a guardian, would be able to hunt deer without having that firearm safety certificate. And would this also be a free license, Mr. Chair, for the deer?
That's my intent.
Okay. And so right now we don't allow 10-year-olds in the state of Minnesota to hunt deer, whether they're with a parent and guardian or not. And as long as the chair is aware that this is going to enter into the arena of allowing those that are younger into big game, and Representative McNamara was talking about it earlier, you're talking some 308s, and you're talking slugs, and you're talking 30-30s, and it's a little bit different than turkey for the safety of the youth, and we would have some concerns on that, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any questions about Representative Moe?
Just a question for the Chair. So is your intention
Chair Dill, to allow kids younger than 12 to hunt deer and use those firearms? Is that what you're getting at here?
That's the intention.
Okay.
I mean, we allow them to ride snowmobile under the supervision of a parent or guardian. There's a lot of things that we allow kids under the age of 12 to do. And I'm saying that we are trying to encourage people to get involved in the sport. And I'm certainly interested in talking about the idea of the big caliber, but I'm thinking about a 10-year-old walking down a cornfield with a shotgun, and his dad is, you know, we had this very discussion in committee for small game hunting. And so I think I'm still working towards looking at that and trying to understand it and do what's right for the public, but also to encourage hunting opportunity for youth, which we are, I think we're declining in those numbers.
Right.
And so that's the reason for bringing this before us and Representative Simpson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think I'd have a little concern about under age 12. We happen to have a tragic accident happen up in our area 2 years ago at deer season time, where a youth was in a stand, and it was early in the morning, it was still dark, and there was a lot of discussion around his deer camp about a bear being in the area. And in the dark, this youth, his father happened to come home and wasn't supposed to be home, and he came out to call up in the stand with the youth. And the youth thought this bear was coming up the stand. So needless to say, we had a very tragic accident. So I'd be a little concerned about anybody under age of 12. So.
But I certainly understand that. But in this instance, the person under the age of 12 wasn't in the accompaniment of a parent or guardian, wasn't being supervised by him.
And he was, because he was put there by his grandfather, who moved to another stand down the way. So I guess,
well, what
however you do it, you're going to have to clarify it, that in the immediate area means 3 feet away or something.
My idea, I guess, is in the stand with him.
Yeah. And if you clarify it that way, Mr. Chairman, that probably would be fine, but I'd certainly want it pretty
tight.
I
guess that's how I envisioned it, but not how it was drafted. So as I said, there's a couple things in here we got to work over. Mr. Hamm.
Also, Mr. Chair, the department would be able to get the numbers for those that hunt big game age 12, 13, 14, and 15, because this would be free, a deer proposal, they would be getting a free license.
Correct.
And we do know how many licenses we're selling to 12, 13, 14, and 15-year-olds. I don't know the number, but I know that we can get it.
And there's also going to be a fiscal impact in this as well, which we need to take under consideration. So, Rick Demo.
Thank you, Chair Dill. Just to be clear, I support what you're trying to get at here. I mean, we've shared this conversation before that we need to recruit more kids. I guess I would just ask that as you go forward with this, you can consult with Colonel Hamm and figure out, you know, what's the safest way to go about actually getting younger kids deer hunting, which I think is a good goal, but we want to make sure we do it right.
Yeah, well, thank you for that, Representative Mullen and Representative Simpson, because I'm just trying, what a purpose of bringing these over and laying these over, and these ones that I'm, I've got a whole pile here, is to have some general discussion on it and try and find out where the different areas lie here and see if we can't come to some agreement and then move it forward. So with that, unless there's further questions, testimony for or against, I don't see Mr. Kelleher here, so we will lay that one over as well. And then I'm trying to get to the bottom of this. We've got just four more to go. 3285 for possible inclusion. This has to do with the turkeys. Turkey licenses. The commissioner shall presume that an app. Oh, okay. Apparently, what is happening is they don't. Says requires that the commissioner of natural resources to presume that an individual applying for a special landowner tenant turkey permit is eligible in order to ensure the timely processing of the application. States that an applicant making a false statement or a licensing agent knowingly issuing a license to an ineligible person shall be subject to penalty as provided under 97A311. This is another item that came from the roundtable. Was brought up in the wildlife section. Mr. Bogus, your thoughts on this?
Mr. Chair and members, right now we're going through a fairly elaborate process of checking landowner applicants ahead of time before we issue the license, and I know there's some concern about that causing a delay in the process. It's under the current application procedures, the application deadline is the first Friday in December, and we usually do the drawing in late January and then make the winners available, or they can check on the internet, or they get a notice in the mail. We're not opposed to what you're trying to do here in terms of just presuming that they're legitimate and then pursuing enforcement action afterwards. We do hear from, we have a lot of avid turkey hunters, and we do hear from some that go through the list, and even with our current screening, they get concerned if they see someone who they don't think was a legitimate landowner. We end up doing some further checking sometimes, so we might have a few more of those slip through, but we're certainly okay with the approach that you're trying to do here.
Okay, question? First demo.
Oh, this would be for you too, Chair. I have a constituent who is a non-tenant landowner who wants to hunt turkeys on his property. This doesn't fix that problem, though.
Non-tenant landowner. They from another state, I think I might have heard from that.
No, he doesn't live on the property, but he lives someplace else.
But he owns the land.
He still owns the land, yeah.
This bill doesn't get to that then, does it?
No, maybe we could do that too, huh?
Okay, well, something to consider.
Yep.
Okay, Representative McNamara.
Mr. Chair, to that point, Representative Moore, the downside of that is that was not the original intent. The intent of it is that it be there's a lot of us that are non-tenant landowners that would then be able to get the turkey licenses, and the folks that want a turkey hunt would, though I guess you're only given 20% of these, and they're going no matter what, or are they on, I guess that'd be a question. That opens up a completely different group of people as opposed to what the original thoughts were here. This would be the farmers that are living on the land instead of somebody that just owns 40 acres as rental property or something. Or it might not even be good turkey land, and then they can end up getting a good permit all the time. I think there's the possibility of that. Because I know we used to have problems with that, but I think we clarified, and you said you're checking on it now, because I think at the beginning it was more people falling through the cracks when we first did this, Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, Representative Mullet, you're right on the origin of this special landowner drawing. It is for up to 20% of the permits, but it was one that was driven by the agricultural interests who wanted the farmers who lived on the property to be eligible, but not the people that owned the recreational land. From the DNR's perspective, we kind of like the system where everybody just gets preference based on how many times they've applied, not been drawn, and getting rid of the requirement to live on would broaden the pool of applicants, and we don't always do the full 20%, so it would reduce the number of permits available to non-landowners if we were to eliminate the requirement that you live on the land, because then anybody with at least 40 acres of recreational land or rental land could qualify for the special drawing.
Okay, anything else on this bill? Okay, we're good. We're going to lay that one over. 3285, we'll lay that one over. Then the next one for consideration to lay over is 3330. Now, this is Uncased Firearm Report. Representative Cornish, you're the co-author on this. I've been doing all the talking. I'd like you to do a little talking.
Mr. Chair, members, what this is we've been knocking the subject around for years, and this year when the question came up, I thought it would be good, to have a study and find out what the story really is on uncased firearms in Minnesota. So sometime between now and next January, I believe that this is commissioning the commissioner to do a study and answer the questions about uncased firearms and safety and violations, and get all the sorts of statistics, how many are written, why, and the reasons behind the law, and the committee report due to both chairs next January. Pretty simple. No action this year, just a study.
Yep. Okay, and Department, Colonel Hamm, you have anything to say about this? No? Okay.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Aguilar.
So what would be the purpose of doing this, Representative Cornish? Are you going to, are we going to pass legislation that's going to allow unscathed rifles then?
Well, Mr. Chair, members, we'll find out next year. I mean, there's always, there's been a push to have more restrictions or less restrictions and to do with shining and this and that, or just all open it up. And there's the reason I think nobody does anything for or against is because we don't have the information. And we never, anything, any way we quantify the results of, you know, what's been done so far in the past 140 years. But anyway, so we'll know next year and we'll have some basis for our decision.
Well, Representative Hackworth, I think you know where the chair lays on this issue.
I'm with you.
I can't think of a state where I hunt, except Minnesota, that doesn't allow this, allow uncased firearms. And I just consider it a safety issue myself. I mean, pulling, you know, in and out. I'm not going to try and sell it here because I mean, we know where the land lies on this, and hopefully we'll get some information. We might be shocked to find out how many tickets actually get or don't get issued and what it really means. In fact, Representative Cornish, could you pull up that email that I sent you over in the House for today? Maybe read that while we're having questions here. That conservation officer wrote. Remember the one I sent you?
I still got that.
Yeah, you probably still. Well, you wouldn't delete an email from me, would you? Representative McNair.
Give me some time. Well, Mr. Chair, I think this will be great information that we bring forward because, as you know, I brought it up and how we guys that do when we hunt in South Dakota or different states and how you can put your guns in the back of the pickup. And it would be illegal here, but I believe it's a much safer situation. So I think this will be good to get this information. And you and Representative, both you and Representative Hackbart might be surprised at what the results could be next year.
Mm-hmm. Representative Cornish, did you find that email?
No, but I remember it. It was in Conservation Officer Tales, and I think it was Joyce Kusky had stopped somebody in, for an uncased gun to check it out, and the guy said that the tie string broke on the case gun, the flap over, and so he tore a piece out of his underwear to use as a string to tie it to finish tying the true story. So he'd be legal. Tore apart his underwear.
Well, I didn't get it right. You got to
put it in there, that's your deal.
Pardon me?
You can't have people tearing their underwear to keep this.
Absolutely not. You can tear it if you go over a barbed wire fence, but not if you got to case your gun. All right, we'll lay that one over. That is, Representative Knuth, do you have anything on that? Okay. And the next bill is 2722. That's also going to be laid over. Representative Cornish, do the bill.
Mm-hmm. Which one?
2722.
Oh.
Your ELF.
Can I just do it from here?
Do it right from there.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, remember what this is we've got hundreds, I suppose, maybe, I don't know if they're thousands or not, but ELS distributors all over the state.
2,200, I think we have.
And when ELS. Somebody comes in to buy a license, if they use a credit card, the credit card company is charging the vendor, and there's no way for the vendor to make that up. Because to do with the current law, they can't charge a surcharge. What this would do is would change that to allow the vendor to charge up to $3.50 if they use the credit card. Now, it also requires a sign be put up to warn the hunter or fisherman that come in that if they decide to use a credit card to purchase that license, that they could receive that surcharge. And, Mr. Chairman, if you do me a favor here, in the interim, when we're thinking about this bill, if anybody from the DNR comes to you and says that this is just a great service to the vendor and they should be lucky to have that, and they keep complaining maybe we'll take away the machine and give it to somebody else, let's take about $1 million out of their budget. I usually really compliment the DNR, but I've had five arrogant responses from them over the last 2 years, making it look like Joe's Hardware in Schmuckatella, Minnesota, it's doing them a big favor to get these ELS machines. And every time you bring it up, they say, well, if it's that much trouble for them to operate this, maybe we should just give it to somebody else. The problem is that these people are making thousands of dollars for the DNR's budget as a service, and they just don't want to lose more money. They're already losing money doing it. And under the premise, the DNR says sometimes that they're bringing in all this business and they buy other things when they're getting their license. But it's a trade-off there. It's a it's a relationship between the public and the DNR that serves the public, or the DNR better than the public, I think. And so I'd just like to be a little more open-minded and work with us on this. And I understand there's a little more problem with the credit card companies, one of them anyway, that we can work on in the interim. But this just allows the vendor to make up the surcharge that he's being charged from the credit card company and get it back from the consumer. And then the consumer can make up the idea whether they're going to do it with the credit card or cash and pay for it. So,
well, Rep. Tim Cornish, I'm in agreement with you on the bill. I think that this is probably the number one thing of all the vendors up in my part of the neck of the woods complain about, is especially during hunting season when the licenses, the prices go up. I mean, hunting licenses are generally more expensive than fishing licenses. And this is my experience in this, is that the fishermen come in to buy a license, and they charge it on a credit card, and then they buy some tackle, buy line, buy this, buy that. The hunters come in and buy a license. They've already brought their bullets, which is about the only thing they need, and they brought all the rest of their stuff and the hunting license. Let me give you an example. I was out pheasant hunting in South Dakota in December, and I went in, we went into the small town about 8 o'clock at night, and we wanted to get our license, which we couldn't do. Because we went to the gas station, and they said, well, we don't sell licenses because they're $100 and some, and we're not taking, and you want to buy it on a credit card, and we're not taking a shellacking on that. So I said, well, you know, I'm out here on vacation. I'm kind of like didn't bring, you know, a lot of money, but I got a credit card. And he said, well, there's one place in town that now sells pheasant hunting licenses, and it's down at the bait shop, and she will still take your credit card. That's how bad it can be, you know, where they just say, we're not going to do it because it costs us money. Not only is there the Represent Simpson, you could tell us more about the fees. I mean, don't you have a transaction fee, plus you have a percentage on everything you do?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. And the only thing that I would say is I think this has merit. And I think the business community is carrying a lot of water for us. But I think if you did, you're really going to open up a can of worms by doing this. I think you may be better off, instead of giving them a dollar for selling that license, maybe better off giving them a couple, $3 or something, and not have it tied to a credit card transaction. Because I think you'll find that you're going to have your service station people come forward. You're going to have, I think it's just going to open up a real big can of worms from the standpoint of everybody that's out there using credit cards is doing a transition fee of some sort. And I just kind of warn you on that. I've never had anybody complain to me, my local game, people that I buy my license from, they never complain to me about the credit card part of it, but they've always told me that they get paid a dollar, I believe, for selling it, and I think the fee is just underrated. So,
does somebody from the department want to address that?
Yeah,
Mr. Boggess, you had talked about it earlier. You want to say anything about it? Everybody pretty much went home, except you. Mr. Shad, are the diehards here.
Mr. Chair, I think you might want to even check into this, because there might be some specifications of the credit card companies that say you cannot charge a fee if you are a MasterCard or a Visa card merchant.
Well,
so you may want to check into that before you get up to prime time.
Our state law, if we adopted this as it is, said you could. Now, if they had a contract with someone that said they couldn't, that would be between them and the card company.
Right.
But the state would be permissive then.
Correct.
And in their next contract that they do, they might be able to negotiate, right, if we adopted it as it's written.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. August?
Mr. Chair and members, we just talked about, at our DNR license center, we sell licenses. That's the only place the DNR actually sells licenses, not using agents. And we do take credit cards, and we do have a contract that says we won't charge an additional fee. And this could set up sort of a unequal playing field, with some charging the fee, some not charging the fee, and I suppose the license buyer could kind of shop around and decide, do they want to pay the fee to use the credit card or whatever. But that's that's just one of the issues that we see with this, is it kind of leaves more discretion to the 1,800 or so agents out there to decide if they're going to take the card and if they're going to charge the fee. And it's going to be tough for people to know where they can use their card, where they can't, and where they have to pay the fee and where they don't. And so I think there's just some issues there we need to think about.
Well, I was just at a, Mr. Bogus, I was just at a gas station this morning in my district before I left to come in here. Big yellow sign right on the thing. No credit cards for licenses. Right on the cash register.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we've got the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And, this is a place where you sell a lot of licenses. And so, I mean, it's not like the problem doesn't exist. And as I said, members, I'm willing to figure out an answer to this if we can work it out. But the problem exists. I suspect you're in the same
way. Oh, yeah, I'm on the bill. Yeah, Mr. Chair, I agree completely. I guess I'd like to dispute the... I think, Mr. Boggs, in places like Bemidji, where there's a half dozen places where you can buy a license, you know, there might be some disparity. But up in Squaw Lake, there's only one place that I know of you can buy a license. And so, you know, they need to recover their costs. You know, people are showing up there, they buy the license, they leave. There's not a whole lot for that store to sell. And so if they take a bath on that license, you know, while they're open and they're losing money for the day. I mean, I think we need to come up with some solution. And if there's credit card companies that won't comply, I mean, maybe we have to kind of get a little creative here. But we need to find a way for those vendors to recover some of those costs, or all of them, preferably.
Also, in South Dakota, where I went to buy my pheasant hunting license, she took a credit card. And the lady took a credit card and she had to stolen it. I asked the question because I knew this bill was going to be, but she said, I'm not taking any checks because that's a guaranteed way to lose my tail. You know, so, I mean, boy, it's really kind of a bad deal. You're going to come up, I think we're going to hear about registrars coming up here. I kind of anticipate registrars going to come before. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jim Hurst. I represent the Minnesota Deputy Registrars Association. In the interest of time and the late hour, I will be as brief as I can, but I thought it might be wise to add a little bit of discussion, a little bit more input to this discussion. The discussion so far has been very accurate on by those who have been making comment. The deputy registrars have been trying to wrestle with this problem as well for the past few years. And deputy registrars not only provide licensing services on behalf of motor vehicle and the Department of Public Safety, but also on DNR-related items as well. We're very interested in Representative Cornish's bill. We have not taken a position on it, but certainly it does open up a few other issues, as Representative Simpson mentioned. Deputy registrars are rather unique in that while they are somewhat considered a retailer in the eyes of a credit card company, we're not the typical retailer in that a grocery store or a Walmart or another retailer is. All of our fees are set in statute, so of course we cannot raise these fees either. We share the same concerns. We are limited in only taking cash or checks as a form of payment. That opens us up to some problems as well, especially when we deal with NSF checks. Overall, though, what I would like to bring to the discussion tonight is that while it is true that the credit card companies do charge a fee at the point of sale, and usually those fees could be anywhere from 2 to 3% on average of the total purchase price, we have recently been made aware that three of the four major credit card companies have now been looking at relaxing their guidelines. And in cases pertaining to government services, and I would argue a game and fish license would be part of that, they have agreed that they would allow a surcharge to be placed at the point of sale with the customer. That's good news, and it's moving us in the right direction. And certainly, with those three credit card companies, Representative Cornish's bill, I believe, would work. The problem is the one outstanding company is Visa, and Visa represents roughly about 60% of the entire market. So there will be more confusion because if Visa doesn't allow it, you could run into the situation where the customer comes up, wants to pay, he's only got a Visa. Sorry, we don't take that card, but we'll take the other one. As you look more into this. It simple solutions are certainly escaping us. In closing, the legislature did have a credit card task force that studied the issue 2 years ago. A copy of that report is available, and any member that wants to review it, I encourage them to do so in this on this topic. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Questions? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll lay that bill over unless there's further comment. Doesn't appear that there is. 2722 is laid over. House File 3043, Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is, you know, I'm not a raccoon hunter, but this was brought to me by a good friend of mine that is a raccoon hunter. Couldn't be here tonight, Mr. Chairman. He called me at the last minute and said that his job wouldn't allow him to come tonight. He had something else that came up, so.
He was skinning coons, right?
He what?
Skinning coons?
No. I'm not sure what he's in the computer business, Mr. Chairman, so he had something he had to do tonight with that. But there were some folks here earlier that on the ammunition issue, I talked to them about this bill. They're raccoon hunters and predator hunters, and they know about this situation, and they agree with this concept. It's just simply changing the hours to make it conform, kind of like what we do with deer hunting. And I don't know of any opposition, Mr. Chairman.
Ben Lamb. Problems with this proposal for your department?
Mr. Chair and members, we don't see any problems with this.
Very good. Any questions by the membership? Okay, there being none, our next meeting is for next Monday. If it may be that as we try and assemble this thing in between now and next Monday, that we need some more thoughts from the membership of this committee, and we'll try and zero in on that. We may end up calling another meeting in between there to talk about some of these issues that we've kind of brought forth in a generic way. So with that, our meeting is adjourned.